So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to review, man.
Oh, it's Matt Pelton to the ladder. Jeff Hardy, the ladder teetering. Edge went down. Christian went down. Matt Hardy's got the money.
Wait.
Show me the money, Matt Hardy.
He can't get it. He got it.
Oh, no. Oh, got the money. The Hardys have. They've won the match. The Brood.
I can't believe it.
That's one of the most amazing displays I have ever seen in my life.
D.I.T. The Carry Invitational Tournament.
That's the first time I heard of y'all, and that's exactly why this track I put a hurting on. Until my ungodly flow has converted all.
My verse is outstanding, punchlines knock you on the canvas like I'm boxing in a title bout landing. Keep the crowd standing, come to see, not for free but dollars. The freestyler that spits without planning. Sold CDs on the road without scanning. With cheap promoters arguing to get my man in. Photographers focusing in Fuji's and Canons. You see the fans in the background usually standing.
Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock, joined as always by Wei Ting. How are you doing, Wei?
I'm doing tremendous. I feel great. We have Tap Out Energies.
We are brought to you, everyone, by Tap Out Energy today. And, you know, here in the Review Away studios, there are usually two of us, but three chairs. But today, all three are occupied. The mystery reviewer. Because when we promise a mystery figure, we reveal it, unlike Raw. Damian Abraham, a fucked up.
Hi, I'm back. Everyone's like, oh, this is going to be like a Michael Cole segment. No, I promise I will sit back. I'm so honored to be here drinking a tap out. I feel like I'm on the Review Away fantasy experience.
This
like
is,
I signed up for
what
rock
you get
camp.
When you come in. You get tap out and you get this lovely studio here.
Well, that believe me, this is like my rock camp. This is like where you get there and there's like Vince Neil teaching you how to grind and stuff. I have John and Wei teaching me how to review wrestling.
See, we were trying to line up a time for Damian to come in. As we had mentioned, we were planning to have him back on. And then me and Damian were chatting and all of a sudden I was like, hey, what if you came in and reviewed No Mercy with us? Thinking that there's no way he's going to have time to watch a three-hour pay-per-view. But let's see here. And you just jumped at this opportunity.
Oh, absolutely.
I was up so till, happy here.
I was up till 4 in the morning.
Oh, Jesus.
And then I fell asleep because we're doing night shoots on The Wedge this week. And so it was a late night, but I was so happy to do this. This is like when you got homework in art class, you know, when you couldn't wait to get home and do it.
Art obviously being subjective week to week on this show.
Art subjective week to week on this show. Art subjective in my life, too. You know, one man's art is another man's 300-pound guy screaming off key.
Very true. Now, No Mercy 99. Sometimes we do this where we look at, you know, where
were you? I know.
In the time period. And where was Damian Abraham in October of 99? And were you following the WWF Attitude Era at this
Well, you
point?
Know what's crazy? I've always in interviews, I think last time here, talked about how I didn't really get into wrestling until my mid-20s. But I think I've been lying to myself about how much wrestling I was watching at this time or just prior to this time because immediately I was like, I know all these storylines, I know all these characters and things like that. I had fallen a little bit out of the product with the product because I had moved to England at this point.
Oh, really?
I just lost my virginity. Yeah, I was really excited.
Is it that why you moved?
Well, I think if I hadn't moved, I would have still been a virgin. But I had, I was 19 years old or just turned 20, and I was yeah. So you know, I by all rights, I should have been a wrestling fan. You know, I didn't lose my virginity until my 20s. Just kidding, guys. Just kidding.
We all perpetuate the stereotype.
I know. I perpetuate it far more than I'd like to admit. But I was I was really surprised at how much I knew about the product. That being said, I don't know if I was a huge fan of a lot of the people, a lot of the talent at this time. So I think I would still watch it, but it wasn't until like, you know, later when I saw, you know, Japanese stuff, ECW stuff that I got really into it and then kind of backwards into all the stuff that I had been watching previous.
Well, at this point, even myself, I wasn't really watching consistently at the time either, but it was really hard to avoid. You know, you would go to school and all your friends would be talking about, oh, did you see what happened on Raw? Did you see Triple H attack Austin? And did you see the Mankind pull a sock out of Val Venus's crotch? People would be asking that.
That's a funny point, because as people think of the WWF boom period, they think of like that 99 to 2001 period. And 2000, I totally get. I think that was their best year. They brought in the Radicals. It was like the in-ring stuff was great. The storylines were clicking. 99, though, it was so popular, and yet you go back, and there was a lot of shit at the time.
Oh, unbelievable, like, amount of... of, like, because you look at this card and you look at the top half of it, and it's pretty consistently amazing, but the first like three or four even are just like, wow, this is, it's kind of like that holdover from that early 90s WWF period where you had like these larger than life characters, which I guess is why they stay in our minds so much. Like you're not going to forget Viscera.
Yeah,
like
they were great in terms of giving these characters personalities, and that's something that I think you can give Vince Russo credit.
Oh, absolutely.
Giving these mid-carders something, and they meant something, whereas you look at today, and it's like there is the top end in the WWE, those couple of guys, and then it's just this jump to John Morrison, and you have these mid-carders that are just kind of lost in the shuffle and don't really have that identity.
Well, it's almost like now compared to then, they're not willing to push anyone. You know, you look at the Road Dogg, and even like the look of these guys, like it stands out. Like the Road Dogg does not look like Billy Gunn, so you remember both of them. Mm-hmm. And whereas now there's like so many guys, as you got creator wrestler type guys that are just like, you know, that almost that overcommitment to keeping it like low key, and I think you need the kind of the mix.
Yeah. Well, I'm guessing the process of acquiring talent back then was a lot more organic, right? Everything would just kind of work out through the systems. You would pick up guys that were creating buzz, but these days it seems to be them picking out people that they think fit a specific mold. Maybe that's why we see so many people that look the same.
And even at this point, I mean, this was when WCW was falling off the rails, but it was still this competition that they had over their shoulder at the time. It was still something ingrained in them that we have this competitor with us, and we have to be putting this product out. And I think it kind of avoided being lazy with characters, and when you had to push guys. And, I mean, Jeff Jarrett was a perfect example here of someone who was able to play both sides off one another. Mm-hmm. And so a very interesting show, and we'll get into it. October the 17th of 1999 from Cleveland, Ohio, in the Gund Arena. And the opening video, it was a mixture of war footage to emphasize the war that we were going to see between Triple H and Steve Austin tonight. And they said that Austin will wage a war until the battle is won. And our announcers tonight, Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler. And the show starts off with The Godfather coming out. And it's funny that we talk about the TNA knockouts at times just pretty much being called the whores.
Oh,
we literally had a group of the whores here for The Godfather here. And it came out without them, gets booed, and then he brings out the women. Giant pop for the hoes. And they had The Godfather. He met with Vince McMahon on Sunday Night Heat, and it was insinuated that he made Vince an offer and thus got booked onto the pay-per-view to face Midian. What a negotiation process. And we get the there was a post-match beatdown from earlier with Midian and Viscera attacking The Godfather. Godfather comes out, does his promo, talking about light that blunt up. This was a different era for modern WWE fans.
Well, watching this, and there's a line coming up in two, like, I think it's just around there where they talk about...
Since it seems like I ain't got no farm animals...
No! See there?
You don't want no hoes, so I'm just gonna kick your ass.
Here we go! No more dealing here. Godfather knows what he come for, and that is to... Well, you heard it. To take care of Midian here.
And remember when Midian talked about those farm animals, he did say he preferred them dead. Ugh.
Midian being into farm animals and how he turned down the offer to have sex with the hoes, but he only likes them when they're dead. And it's like, this is so far removed from the John Cena era. It's very clear right off the bat that this is not going to be what we've seen.
This was trash TV, but at the time... It was all the rage because it was so different.
Heels were into bestiality was the moral of this.
It was really like, I mean, Russo, this was...
Well, Russo had left by this point.
Yeah. Did he actually leave by... How long ago?
He had left about 3 weeks before this, and his first Nitro he was going to write was the night after this pay-per-view.
But I think even like that's the only way you can get this pimp character over as a babyface is by making the heel so repulsive that you're like, oh, this guy that's basically keeping these women in sexual enslavement isn't so bad.
Well, like, no, nobody thinks about that.
No one thinks about that. That's true.
Pimps are,
the women are happy. They're with the Godfather.
Well, and they can you imagine? Is there a less charismatic group of women that they could have picked than the hoes? Like
that was the deal. Was that every show? They would have the Godfather and maybe someone else. They would go to the local strip club the night before and just grab some women and say, do you want to be on our show tomorrow? And it was the greatest gig in the world for this guy who then opened up his own strip club, Cheetahs, in Las Vegas.
Charles Wright?
Oh, really?
Yeah, he runs a strip club.
Oh, that's a famous – that's where all, like, the rappers go. I think it's even in some rap songs they talk about Cheetahs.
Why wouldn't he call it Godfathers?
I guess Cheetahs is a play on words.
He's going PG. Okay. You know, he's got to deal with Mattel to market these strippers, and so he's going...
Imagine Mattel coming into this company. It's like, well, we want Midian to be sold with a plastic chicken.
Yeah.
A dead one.
I think also, like, the thing about the Godfather is you had such an opportunity. If you're making this larger-than-life extreme pimp character, why not have a larger-than-life valet that's like his top girl type thing that pimps always had their top girl who's tough,
the head ho,
like just like having like that beside him I think would have been way better than these uncharismatic bad dancers that
I think that would have been an idea, but they just wanted them to parade women basically. So
they announced that the main event tonight with Austin and Triple H, it has been made a no holds barred match, and the match starts off and this was a classic. We saw a power slam by the Godfather. He Irish whipped Midian into the corner, teases the hoe train, but gets distracted by Viscera, who is approaching the hoes, and this leads to Midian gaining the advantage after Viscera slams the Godfather back first into the ring. Midian's then choking on the Godfather on the top rope right in front of the hoes, who are just appalled here at their leader here being taken advantage of.
They were so appalled.
The irony.
They were so appalled, they were cheering.
Yeah, they didn't exactly know the story of the match.
No, they're not following the product.
These were like, I'm not trying to make this analogy, but it was like the prior month at Unforgiven, the dogs coming out for the Kennel from Hell match, and they didn't know their spots. It's like the hoes didn't know the spots here in the match.
Perfect
analogy.
They
were cheering the heel.
Where was Teddy Hart training those dogs? You know?
Teddy Hart probably was having that match, that Kennel from Hell, it might have, that was the seed being planted in Teddy Hart's head. He's like, if only those dogs were trained properly, this could change the business. Jim Ross is noting that there is nothing fancy or scientific about Midian's approach, which I think everyone in the audience would agree with. Godfather makes his comeback, he hits the hoe train, and then a schoolboy roll up for the win. 7 minutes and 31 seconds. Not much of a match here, but fuck was the Godfather over in 1999.
It's crazy. Yeah. I think that's the one thing also about this show is like, You watch a show now and you're like, wow, people like Cena or they hate Cena, they like Punk or whatnot. Not compared to here. Like that, the reactions people get now is almost like a silence compared to the reactions.
Yeah, like imagine an opening match guy in the WWE getting this level of
like
reaction.
Like everyone, you know, doing all his lines. Every single person also had a sign in that crowd too, I noticed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that, those sing-along promos, they might have been annoying to some, but it was something instant that the crowd latched onto.
Oh, absolutely.
And it was evident with Road Dogg on this, with Rock. It was like, it was a very good formula for baby faces, and the crowd just loved chanting with these people.
And I think anything can become a chant, too. If you just, the repetition gives it that chant. I just don't think now they're giving guys the promo time. Like, CM Punk is off TV now for a little bit, you know. But if you kept him on and gave him some sort of phrase, or let him come up with a phrase, you know, that would get that sort of reaction. I think, you know, you just need someone to get behind. And I think then they were just more willing to get behind guys and give them the opportunity to kind of cut an after-match promo or before-match promo.
I'm always amazed that this would be what this Charles Wright would always be remembered for. The guy had a great run as Papa Shango.
Yeah.
Whatever. But this was
Are not great characters. Well,
Papa Shango was an awesome character. Are you kidding me?
Yes, the man who gave the Ultimate Warrior appendicitis on live television and goo from his face.
That was cool.
But this was a much more well remembered character. Absolutely.
Yes.
They show a video of Triple H from last week where he was left in a room with a rattlesnake, and where we were led to believe that he was bitten by a snake. And because of this, the what Austin caused, he was going to give up the title, but it was all a swerve to attack Austin in the locker room. And then they show a segment from Sunday Night Heat earlier in the night where Triple H was interviewed, bragging about his performance on SmackDown being an Academy Award-winning performance. Little would we see the actor Triple H would become later on. Says that when the door closed, the snake did try to bite him, but he ripped its head off and threw it in the trash, and says he has made Austin the most pissed off he's ever been. And then the interview just like gets cut off mid-sentence here, and they go to the next video, which is Michael Cole with Ivory. Bunch of old jokes towards Fabulous Moolah and Mae Young, and says that she is the only real women's champion, and that would lead to this classic, Ivory against Fabulous Moolah for the women's title.
With Mae Young, because Mae Young bumps like crazy in this match, too.
Was this the point, Damian, where you were starting to regret taking us up on our
offer? No, because I actually, you know what, I don't like Moolah as a face. I liked her. I think she's an amazing heel when kind of her older run stuff. But I still think this match, you know, it's more entertaining than a TNA knockout match, you know? Like, yeah. There's, like, at least they're doing something new. It's not just, like, you know, like, later on, what they did with these two older women was a little weird.
This was pre-hand.
Pre-hand and pre-Bubba Bomb and, like, pre-like, all these other things. So, you know, like, imagine seeing this at the time, like, seeing these older women getting knocked around. Like, this would be pretty exciting.
If you recall at this time, Moolah and Mae Young got the call to be on the MTV Video Music Awards to present an award. It was like they had their pick of who they wanted, and the WWF sent those two, and it was great. They did like bumps on the stage and stuff. It was like, it was amazing. Here we are, Moolah and Mae Young on the MTV Video Music Awards.
It's amazing.
Hosted by Chris Rock.
And they're both, I think they're both also just like such great performers that even like, it's like, you know, not that Ric Flair's this old, but like it's like watching a Ric Flair that like, even though he can't do physically, you know, he's very limited at this point physically in what he can do, or not so much Ric Flair, but they still make it interesting because they're still great with the psychology. They're still great with just kind of working the audience.
The match starts off. Ivory hits a drop kick from behind, and Mae Young gets onto the apron and is watching on. There's a snapmare to Moolah. Moolah then dives off the first turnbuckle, misses Ivory. Ivory tries to use the ropes, and Mae gets knocked off her feet here. Then Mae gets knocked to the floor. This was the craziest bump on this show.
It is one of the, and this is a show with ridiculous bumps the whole way. I just kind of wish Mae had done color. I wish she had pulled a blade job, because if she had gotten up with blood running down her face, I don't know how much she can spare at this point, but it would have been.
This was like the women's version of Mick Foley in the Hell in a Cell.
Exactly.
Like Mae was like, how old would she have been by this point? She was like 80, at this point, taking this crazy back bump off the apron to the floor, and they replayed this with Lawler howling at this woman who might be dead.
This is also the point where I realized that, you know, Michael Cole, kind of unwatchable. Jerry Lawler at this point was pretty annoying in his own right.
Yeah, this was when he was in full, like, just wanted to...
Pervert mode.
Yes, pervert mode,
but also just, like, constantly berating you with it to the point where it's distracting, because I think this is Jim Ross's, one of his peaks as a play-by-play.
Jim Ross, I thought, especially on this show, he was such a great straight man.
Oh, yeah.
That he would just, like, not no-sell Lawler's stuff, but it was like he always kept his credibility intact and let Lawler just run wild, and he would just be the straight man.
Yeah.
And I thought it just made for such a better dynamic than if Ross were to get involved with, you know...
Michael Cole.
Exactly. So after Mae takes this drop kick to the floor, Ivory goes for a suicide dive to the floor on Fabulous Moolah. I'm sure in her head this was a great idea, but this was the worst suicide dive ever, and almost earned its name here, because Ivory just plummeted to the ground.
She ate it on that.
I don't know how she got up. It looked like her face just smashed into the ground. So all of them are fighting on the floor. Mae took the most bumps out of all three in this match. Ivory grabs the title, clocks Mae off the apron, who goes off the apron again. And then Moolah rolls up Ivory in a bit of a sloppy fashion. 2 minutes and 56 seconds. I thought this was a bit of a car wreck.
It was a bit of a car wreck, but, you know, every single one of those people had far more presented than, like, a Kelly. Now, like, none of these divas in the current
WWE... Everyone ran the ropes better in this match.
Oh, everyone. But, like, in the current WWE, like, none of these you know, even more than the men, none of these women stand out because there's no personality, and they've really kind of gone for a cookie cutter effect, which doesn't really work when you have heels and baby faces because they all look kind of the same.
It's just kind of interchangeable parts, much of a storyline.
And then it's all held together by the glue that is Kelly Kelly.
She is the glue in that whole entire division.
Well, nobody's judging this match based on any type of technical ability, but it was just a fun match based on the stunts. Mm-hmm. These old ladies getting hurt. Who doesn't want to see that?
It's like watching kids fall on a YouTube video.
It is.
It's just something awesome. You have to enjoy.
WWE should just make a LOL Cats video, and they will the rating would go through the roof. Just put that on SmackDown.
WWE Network. Yeah. There you
WWE
go.
WWE Network, an LOL Cats thing.
Yeah. Go back to Sunday Night Heat. Vince McMahon is talking to Triple H and saying that Hunter's strategy won't work in a no-holds-barred match, and Hunter's upset at this stipulation being thrown here at the last minute into his match. New Age Outlaws come out. Very big reaction. Road Dogg does his promo. Like we said earlier, New Age Outlaws here were as over as anyone else on this show. And it really just shows you it made the whole promotion feel hot when you had these guys coming out and the way the crowd reacts to these baby faces and against the heels. It makes the product feel hot when you've got the reactions like this.
Because I had kind of fallen out of the product at this time, how long ago had DX broken up?
They hadn't.
They hadn't?
They had broken up earlier in the year when Hunter had gone heel, but then they reformed them right around this time. They were all going to go heel at this point.
Okay, because I was they still have DX in their Titantron videos.
It was weird. They broke up the group, and then they had Road Dogg and Billy Gunn feuding for a while over the rights.
I remember that.
They kept DX there because it was such a hot merchandise seller. It would have been silly to just remove it altogether, but... the group is going to be put back shortly after this pay-per-view in a heel form. So we got the New Age Outlaws against Hardcore and Crash Holly. Billy Gunn was wearing these neon green tights that were see-through with a thong underneath.
Yeah, there's something distracting right on his wiener that I just kept what is that weird blue rainbow thing on his private parts?
I didn't understand this Mr. Ass character.
But I don't know what what do you do with him?
It was funny. It was just funny how he went from he was badass Billy Gunn to they said, no, let's literally make him
an
Mr. Ass,
man.
Ass, where his ass is the focal point of everything.
Yeah. Hey, it worked. Got him over. It's his most recognizable name. He tried to go with the one? It didn't work.
The one was after this. And then he had that great run with Chuck.
Billy and Chuck.
Yeah. Billy Gunn had just won the King of the Ring a few months before this.
Did he?
He's one of the ones that everyone brings up as someone that didn't really go anywhere. Him and Mabel.
The ones that just didn't quite make it. So we start off, Road Dogg hits a shake, rattle, and knee drop as Billy Gunn distracts Mike Chioda. The Hollies get the heat after Crash sends Road Dogg over the top rope into the floor, tags in Hardcore Holly, who hits a delayed vertical suplex to Road Dogg. They continue to work over Road Dogg. Billy Gunn's yelling in the corner at the referee. He yells out, I guess you missed that too, idiot. Holly hit this fantastic-looking dropkick. This guy, just a phenomenal dropkick.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the better ones you will see.
I thought he was an amazing guy in this match. Just the way he worked, I thought was awesome.
Hardcore Holly was someone that he was always around that mid-card mix and would always get injured at bad times and just never really got his break. And when he did, it was his neck by Brock Lesnar.
And he seems to have been kind of a mean guy from various accounts I've
heard. Yeah, he wasn't exactly the Be a Star representative at the time. Jim Ross played... this was actually where I wrote down about Ross being just such a great straight man, because Lawler talked about, Ross said that Hardcore Holly has a really short fuse, and then Lawler came back and said, hey, don't let Hardcore hear that. Don't talk about his fuse like that, trying to make a dick joke out of this. And Ross just no-sells it almost. And I enjoyed just Jim Ross in this entire show, I thought. It just added a lot of credibility, and it really just kind of accentuated what his strengths are that they're really not catering to at all now.
Well, it also made every match feel like a big event. Like, you're lucky to be watching this pay-per-view right now, not like, hey, we're going to put on this weird act that's going to totally distract from the pay-per-view for you.
Yeah. Road Dogg is just selling for minutes on end here. He comes back with a superplex to Hardcore Holly. Both are selling. They make the tag. Billy Gunn gets into the ring. And then all four are in the ring. The referee is distracted as Hardcore Holly tosses a chair into the ring to Crash. But Billy Gunn comes and hits the Famouser onto Crash on the chair. And that leads to the DQ finish at 10 minutes and 12 seconds. Shitty finish here.
Well, I thought these first three finishes were kind of weird, too, because the first two matches ended with sort of roll-ups.
Yeah.
Like, and like kind of TNA style, I guess.
Yeah,
but,
roll-up, they love
and
the, that.
And then this was a DQ finish. There was a lot of kind of screwy finishes on this show.
It was weird. It was like, what, we can't beat the Hollies here? We got to protect both teams.
But I guess you're also still building, like, even though they're not supposed to be building to TV, their TV numbers were so huge at this point.
That this was, they were just through the roof at this point. And after the match, Road Dogg hits the pump handle slam to Hardcore Holly. This was his doggy style pump handle slam, where he would insinuate that he was fucking the guy in the ass before he hit the pump handle slam. Mm-hmm. Some great stuff at the time.
The gimmick. Listen, at the time, I think we all enjoyed this stuff, though.
No, people were into
back,
it.
It's so ridiculous, but at the time, like, Jerry Springer was hot on TV.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's like everything about this feels like it just seems like a, not to be totally ridiculous, but like a pre-September 11th kind of thing. Like, they're from the very first promo video where you have the war images, and it's like, oh yeah, this was before, like, this is when it was still a world away, and it, just, all this sort of humor just felt like, you know, maybe it's coming back in vogue now, but at the
South Park was big at the time.
South Park was huge, and you know, even you know, Eminem had just kind of was big, Blimp Biscuit, like that whole like. Yeah, dumb culture.
Well, and there's something I want to follow up with on that after this next video. And it was for the Jeff Jarrett China match. And they showed Jeff Jarrett attacking all the women, including Moolah and Mae Young. They showed from the last pay-per-view, Unforgiven, where Deborah turned on Jeff Jarrett, laid him out with a guitar, and then China had supposedly won the IC title, but Tom Pritchard reversed the decision because of the interference. It led to a tag match the next night on Raw, where China and Deborah defeated Jarrett and Pritchard to allow China to get the rematch at this pay-per-view. And then they just showed, like, angle after angle after angle between these two. This included Jeff Jarrett attacking China with a coffee urn, a toaster. Then China got her comeback, where she took the pants off of Jeff Jarrett and wore them as a metaphor. Then we saw Jarrett attacking more women with the figure four. And it culminated with China being thrown into a laundry hamper, wheeled to the back, and then tossed off of a ledge, where they opened the hamper and China's head was all bloody. And it was like, these were like these major angles that were just thrown out every week on TV. And that's what a lot of people look at in terms of, yes, it was a great period for the WWF, but they did stuff like this every week on television that years later, it was hard for people to get into angles and storylines to mean anything when they had seen everything. Buses exploding, women thrown off ledges, and I mean, this was basically the same angle we saw where Terry Funk and Cactus Jack were tossed off on that dumpster.
Yeah, the dumpster thing.
This was just another angle here for a mid-card match. It was like so much stuff was done during this attitude period where they just felt they had to shoot all these big angles. And I thought this was this video was like, holy Christ, how much stuff did they do in the 3 weeks between pay-per-views here?
Well, it's also funny because China is a mega heel, like, or with Triple H, who's a mega heel.
Yeah.
And in earlier, it's like going up to Steve Austin, like, I hope you're happy, setting him up to get jumped by Triple H.
I noted that, yeah.
And here she is meant to be this incredibly sympathetic babyface. And on the same show, you're meant to, it's like, this was Vince Russo era, even though Vince Russo had left by this point. But, like, there's, like, you know, all the angles being thrown out every week, something new and extreme. It just kind of tires you out. It's like going to see a band where the person screams the whole set.
Yeah, and this was also, they had just debuted SmackDown. So you were getting 4 hours a week now of WWE. And it wasn't, you didn't have the brand split. So it was you were seeing these characters two more hours of each week. And it was just filling a lot of time with a lot of big stuff.
But the show Heat, I think they really use, you see how great effect they could use that show. And it's like, why don't they have those lead-in Sunday shows anymore?
I thought it was really good because they referenced Heat like multiple times.
Yeah.
And if you just tuned into this pay-per-view, you would have come out of this saying, I should watch Heat next time because it set up a lot of stuff on the pay-per-view. And Sunday Night Heat at one point was doing numbers that are higher than what Raw is doing today.
And I can't even imagine them doing a major angle on SmackDown at this point, like without bringing it into Raw and introducing it on Raw, let alone on like, you know, the superstars or the equivalent of.
Yeah, yeah, well, I thought they had a great formula with Heat when they first introduced it, and it would lead into Raw the next night. It was before SmackDown, and Heat was doing like 3 fives and stuff on USA. I mean, it was a gigantic hit for them.
That was the B show, though. That was a time when Raw was doing much higher than that, wasn't it?
It was, but in terms of numbers, it actually isn't that far off from what, like, a 5.0 at that time was like, it's not like a ridiculous amount more than what a, say, 3.8 would translate to today. It's just USA Network's in so many more homes now. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to look back at their TV model in 99. And that takes us here to Jeff Jarrett, who is accompanied by Miss Kitty, Stacy Carter, against China in the Good Housekeeping match for the Intercontinental title. And I guess we should give the backstory here. This was Jeff Jarrett's last night with the company. His contract had expired the night before, and this was a bit of an oversight by the company, who said, well, can you come drop the title for on Sunday? And Jarrett said, sure, of course, but it's going to cost you 6 figures. And the company was basically held ransom here that this guy, they had put the title on, his contract expired the day before the pay-per-view. And that ransom is pretty much why Jeff Jarrett was never brought into WWE after WCW went out of business.
Oh, really?
So in a weird way, this oversight kind of, in a weird way, led to TNA. Because I'm sure Jarrett would have been one of the many contracts picked up, and he would have been in the company at that point.
Yeah. Well, if you remember that episode of Nitro, the final episode of Nitro during the simulcast, Vince starts off the episode of Raw saying, you know how Jeff Jarrett spells his name J-A-R-R-E-T-T? Well, tonight, he's going to spell it G. Here's how he said, double G, double O, double N, double E, which to me reads Goonie.
Right? He was a huge fan of that series, of that Goonies movie, and he wanted to have him a Goonie gimmick when he came
Goonie
in.
Vince can't spell. But this match, the Good Housekeeping match, and each come out with different kitchen housekeeping objects. We saw a table outside the ring with a coffee machine, fruit. I think they had literally taken the catering table from the back and just brought it outside. They're like, bananas here, coffee. And it starts off with a trash can lid shot by China. She hit Jeff Jarrett with a toilet seat. There was a stick of salami in here. And then a banana was shoved in Jarrett's mouth. I think between the stick of salami and a banana being put in Jarrett's mouth, that they were trying to subtly say something, I think, here, with these objects going into his mouth. Or was I just reading too much into these phallic symbols?
I don't think you could read. I think that's giving WWF at this time too much subtlety credit. Because I think they would have been like, she would have been sticking it back and forth in his mouth for a good 2 or 3 minutes.
Put the whipped cream on top.
Whipped cream on top. Yeah.
And 12 years later, China would be doing that professionally.
Cool.
So she, maybe this was
a... How did she become a worse actress? Like, you watch her on The Surreal Life, she's nowhere near as good as she was at this point in acting.
Yeah, this was that's quite the task she undertook. We saw whipped cream here. China then missed an elbow off the apron and goes through a table. It was all China at the start of this match. Jarrett comes back with trash can shots to the head of China and then threw a piece of fish at her, like this giant fish. Jarrett and Miss Kitty then put a bunch of eggs and milk into a pot, but China throws the powder into Jarrett's face. This was like Memphis wrestling at its finest here, this match. So Miss Kitty ends up in the ring. China gets the pot, pours it over Miss Kitty's head, and Jarrett then gets China from behind, puts her in the figure four, but China reaches the ropes. And then China gets out, recovers, grabs a pair of tongs, and applies the tongs to Jeff Jarrett's balls, throws pies into his face, hits him with a kitchen sink. Jarrett kicks out. Crowd was into this near...
Oh, absolutely.
And then Jarrett goes for... China goes for the pedigree, but Jarrett counters it, slingshots China into referee Teddy Long, and then Jarrett hits a belt shot and pins China. So we all think, we got the swerve here. Oh, this is going to be problematic. This is my next set of notes, so I'm going to need some help.
Do you want to use this page?
Sure.
What page is that?
Oh, no.
Oh, you
different.
Know what?
Those
I didn't
different.
Print this off twice. We'll get through it.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll be fine.
I can make it out.
Oh, yeah, this is not at all
think,
what we're doing.
We think that China has won. That China has lost this match, and this was the big swerve, that Jeff Jarrett's leaving with the title. But the WWE all night long was thinking, how can we swerve them? What great reason can we give? And Teddy Long says, no, Jeff, a title belt is not a household object. And therefore, the match continues. And China comes back and hits Jarrett with a guitar. And China pins Jeff Jarrett. 8 minutes and 40 seconds.
There was also that amazing, I think, where she gets the, or Jarrett does the Irish whip spot, and China stops a good 3 feet before the turnbuckle and then just like does a jumping flip over the rope.
Yeah.
Over the top rope to the floor. Mm-hmm. A little bit, not quite Ric Flair in that move, or Shawn Michaels.
No. Ray Stevens was just shaking his head, looking at this spot that Joni Lauer was perfecting.
Is the guitar a household item?
Well, that's what they say. Jerry Lawler's like, the guitar's not a household item. And then Jim Ross is like, yes, it is. And I think you could make more of an argument that a guitar is more of a household item.
That makes sense, because Long was pissed off. That's right. But why would Long make the count in the first place after the belt shot?
Belt shot, yeah. Well, because did he not see it? Is that...
He'd been knocked out, and then he came to here for the finish after Jarrett had hit him with the belt. Hit her with the belt.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not intentional.
This was a fun plunder match.
It was. And exactly what you wanted. It was.
And it's also one of those
match.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where like they threw everything, including the kitchen sink, out there, and it's yes. You know, it's one of those reasons that these sorts of matches don't hold a lot of effect at this point, because you've seen literally everything in a plunder match. Mm-hmm. So, like, when you see a plunder match, unless it's someone, you know, like a Necro Butcher, there's nothing they can do to really shock you because you've seen everything.
That was always the difficulty with the hardcore division when they were doing, you know, the 24/7 gimmick and trying to come up with anything unique because everything was done. And Crash Holly had a decent run where he'd go to all these amusement parks.
But they missed the point of hardcore matches.
They made them comedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're not hardcore matches because of the various weapons that are involved. That's just somebody's idea of what a hardcore match should be. But like, what made ECW successful was the drama involved in using these weapons.
And the fact that it would be a long match where you'd be you build to these spots and not just have and where do you go with like how violent can you make this? Like, can you have someone bring an axe eventually and things like that? That's the other thing when you watch this show. It's like there's nowhere to dial it up. Like, there's so much innovation on this show, like as far as the ladders and things like that, that now when you look at it, you're like, how do you dial this up in the present day? And that's where someone like Teddy Hart comes in.
That's when you gotta. That's the next step. So Miss Kitty ends up leaving with China, and this would be the end of Jeff Jarrett. And this was when China and Miss Kitty would come out to Master and Slave shirts after this, where Kitty would be China's slave.
China also would get beaten up in all these angles. Like, anytime she seemed to be involved in an angle broken off, it was like Chris Jericho. There more later on, where it just seems like she was. Someone hated her backstage.
Which made me wonder how much of this was shown on TSN, who was notorious for cutting all this, anything involving women.
I think they edited probably a lot of this out, because I don't foresee them showing China getting thrown off a laundry hamper off a ledge. And then there was, you're right, the Jericho angle. We remember we talked about where he beats her with a hammer.
He breaks her hands with a hammer backstage.
Yeah, which is a household object.
Which is a household object. He could have won.
By Teddy Long logic.
Player, I found that in the house.
Teddy Long is like a defense lawyer for like a spousal abuse victim.
Well, that should be the way they go with this whole, what's his name, lawyer gimmick.
David Otunga.
Teddy Long should take night school classes and start battling him out in the court.
There you go. We go back to our next match. And by the way, Jeff Jarrett, he would show up on Nitro the very next night. So one of the rare times that you would see a performer go from one company to the next in a 24-hour time period. Next up, we get a video for The Rock and the British Bulldog. Bulldog says the only thing he cares about is winning the WWF title. Bulldog costs The Rock in a title match with Triple H. And then it ends with The Rock hired a bunch of dogs backstage, carried their shit onto a tray, and then... Rock bottomed the British Bulldog onto a pile of dog shit, and that was the heat for this pay-per-view blow-off.
Yeah. It's weird to see Rock in the mid-card, though.
He was just in this nothing.
Nothing. Literally a nothing mid-card match.
This was it's like we always hear about, you know, the WWF at times. They'll take real-life situations and throw them onto TV. I remember at this time, Bret Hart was doing his column in the Calgary Sun at the time. And like 2 months before this was when British Bulldog had signed with the WWF. And Bret was very upset that Bulldog was going back to the WWF. This was after Owen had died and everything that had gone down. And Bret wrote his column, and he ended it by saying, you know, the other day I was in the park, and I saw these dogs laying around in their own feces. I couldn't help but think of some of my family members doing whatever it takes to get work in this business. Something to that effect.
Wow.
And then a month later, they booked this angle where Bulldog is left laying in shit. Oh. And it's like, yeah, coincidence? No coincidence happened in this company.
No.
Never, ever do they happen.
That, and also, it's is this like, did Bulldog have one more run after this?
This was it, right?
Yeah, because it's pretty, he was my favorite wrestler when I was a little kid, like when they had the big rubber figures, and to see him at this point was not what I remembered.
Just,
and
this was after the WCW run. He had nearly died earlier in the year, and
considering he looked pretty good, considering that he
looked pretty big,
died.
Considering the guy was 175 pounds when he came to Canada in the 70s, and at this point, how much 290 he looked here?
He's huge.
Yeah. I mean, this guy had a physique like mine. Like ridiculous.
He had weird. His skin went into weird, like leathery folds at the armpits that were very distracting for me.
Mm. Like this guy was. What he did to his body to succeed. But, you know, you can look at, had he not put that extra weight on, he was going nowhere in this business.
Well, like, look at, you know, Dynamite Kid.
Yeah,
like,
both of them.
You know, probably the more talented of the two, and, you know, other than Japan, never really made it on his own.
So we got British Bulldog and The Rock. And this was British Bulldog 2000 gear. The Union Jack was gone, and he had the jeans, socks, and black boots.
Well, he had just debuted because they even showed him in his Union Jack gear in the promo package.
Yes. But this was the updated version of the Bulldog. And what did you think of his attire, Wei? Future World Champion gear?
Not at all. I mean, I don't know what they're intending to do with this whole run. I'm guessing just to give the Rock another month. But
this
was the
90s philosophy of jeans equal tough.
Nobody saw the Bulldog near the level of the Rock, both in promo and as well as stature.
He also had like a vague kind of skinhead vibe because he had the jeans tucked into the white socks and like big heavy boots. Hmm. And I was like, that would be, for a heel, kind of like a way more effective look. I'm not saying you have to do, you know, the neo-Nazi stuff, but just like that kind of like tough, scary
Alex
kind of
cornered the market on that at the time. Berlin. So the match kicks off. They note that The Rock, who had just won the tag titles with Mankind, did not come out with his tag title.
Neither one did, too. Later on, Mankind doesn't either.
No. And then, did
Are
he?
Sure, I think
I
he
can't
did.
Remember.
Did he come out with it?
I think he might have.
I apologize. He doesn't walk away with it, at least, or didn't hold it up at the end, but I guess it's not a tag team match. Anyway,
he had something more important. He had socks at the end.
That's true. He had to have both socks on.
Bulldog gets clotheslined to the floor. They fight by the timekeeper's table. He attacks Rock with a chair, and then Bulldog gets thrown into the steps. And this was Bulldog, a year prior, had suffered this nasty staph infection from his back for that the Ultimate Warrior surprise, the trap door in WCW. So his back had been an absolute mess. He developed a crazy painkiller addiction, and there were just crazy stories of him backstage and just completely out of things. Back in the ring, they fight. Bulldog took a flip bump into the corner off the Irish whip. I mean, the guy was, I think in his head, probably was thinking, this is like my chance to make any impact in this company, is just bumping my ass off for the one of the top guys in the company. Just, I don't know. This match, I wrote down lots of punching and more punching. Rock knocks Earl Hebner down at one point, hits a DDT to Bulldog for a two count. Bulldog comes back with his power slam, but Rock is into the ropes, so there is no cover. Goes for it again, gets reversed. Bulldog gets sent into the corner. Rock hits the Rock Bottom and then the People's Elbow, and he gets the win. 6.5 minutes. Just a very mid-card match.
Yeah, and there's like the super long kind of rest spot in the middle, too, where there's like a choke spot. And yeah, like I once again, being a Bulldog fan, I was a little sad.
It's just, yeah, crowd didn't really... I don't think they took Bulldog too seriously at this point.
They definitely love when The Rock just did the people's eyebrow for, yes, like, the entire time up and down the ramp. Like, they were just like... It looked like he was just doing that over and over again.
Yeah, they popped for all of Rock's big stuff, but it was... This was kind of just a transitional pay-per-view for The Rock.
But I guess you had so many main eventers at that point, you could afford to kind of have a main eventer in a mid-card spot, like kind of just taking, you know, time off from a big angle and kind of saving them.
Yeah. Then we go back to Sunday Night Heat, and Terry Runnels is standing on a ladder, and Jerry Lawler is asking her to explain how to win a ladder match, and Terry says, well, you have to climb. And she was wearing a miniskirt and was ascending the ladder as Jerry Lawler was trying to look for her vagina. Is that about what was going on here? And then Terry was yelling, can you see it? Can you see it? Jerry's like, I think so. Terry says, you haven't seen anything yet.
This is so fine, sad. This is somebody's mom.
Well, I wonder...
If Dakota's mom.
You realize if this was 2011, Lawler would have taken a picture on his camera phone and then said that... And then they would have ended up in court.
Well, he's, like, more obsessed with it than New Jack is.
Yes.
Like, he really is more obsessed with those nude pictures and nudity involving Terry Reynolds than New Jack.
And that takes us to our ladder match. It's the, I believe it was a best of five series, the Terry Invitational Tournament, which, in case you didn't get it, folks, Jerry Lawler spelt out for us, T-I-T. And they were battling for $100,000 and the managerial services of Terry Runnels so that Lawler could remind us and make as many entendres as possible about Terry's services coming their way.
It made little sense for Terry to be involved.
Oh, Jesus.
We almost had
good
a
save.
Tap
that
out.
Was an amazing save.
We almost had a tap out explosion here in the Review Away Studios.
We almost had to tap out for a moment.
Oh.
You can use that tap out.
This whole Terry Reynolds thing just doesn't seem to fit with either of these teams. Nowhere in these teams' aesthetics did they seem to say that they would want a manager, first of all. Secondly, a manager like Terry Reynolds, who does not fit with either team at all.
Well, let's not forget what Gangrel would do a few short years later when he would start his adult film career. So,
oh, that's right.
You know, like maybe he did require those services for some early demos that's he was working on.
Disgusting. I think the belief at the time was that these were four very, you know, good, you know, performers that just they didn't have any personality.
Oh, no,
really,
mic
at the time.
Skills.
They had been given nothing really at this point, and maybe the idea of attaching them to someone like Terry, who wasn't doing anything, was their hope of maybe getting people invested in these four, who thankfully, I mean, put together great stuff in the ring, and that was going to get them over. But I don't even know if you know, WWF officials at this time could have imagined this ladder match coming off as well mm-hmm. as it mm-hmm. could for these four. I mean, these four were – that's what this show is remembered for is this ladder match here. So Gangrel comes out with the Hardys, who at this point were simply called the New Brood.
And they had dropped the gimmick, but Gangrel hadn't, of being vampires?
Yes.
Okay.
There's that rule in wrestling that the new anything, not a great idea.
No, and also, like, why keep that holdover? Like, why not give Gangrel a new look, too?
I think they liked the music, and that was about it, which, when it was with Edge and Christian, I mean, that was a fantastic entrance at the time.
Oh, absolutely.
They would come up.
And the blood that would come out and all that stuff was fun.
It worked for Edge and Christian, who were, like, these goth characters
yeah.
at the time, but the Hardys were, like... I don't
at
know.
The time
like,
it worked,
like,
it
they were like pre-emo at the time.
It worked for the Hardys at the time, too. They didn't really have too much of an identity by themselves yet.
Well, but this is like after they broke off with Michael Hayes and they kind of became like – they almost absorbed the Headbangers gimmick. Like they both look kind of like – they like that's when Hardy's, I guess, wearing the stockings on the arms and stuff like that. And it kind of felt like they looked vaguely
the
like –
Hot Topic crowd. Was
yeah, the Hot Topic. Yeah, if only they'd come out now.
Man.
You know, they could – Matt and Jeff could be the top guys in the business.
The best was that they would wear like the baggy jeans and the tight like shirts.
Yeah.
And then Michael Hayes, like 50-year-old Michael Hayes would dress in it as well yeah. with like a cane. Only Michael Hayes could pull off anything, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
And it was, I always enjoyed Michael Hayes in an on-screen role.
To me, though, that was like...
Such a weird mix, though.
When he came out with that with the Hardys, like, this wasn't Michael Hayes. This was Doc Hendricks, the guy
That's true.
Who yeah.
Did they call him Doc Hendricks at the time? I can't remember.
No, I think they called him Mike Hayes.
Yeah, and they did call him Michael Hayes. Yeah. But I'm just saying, I recognize this guy from the Slam Jams between commercials.
Well, it was before I knew who the Fabulous Freebirds were or, like, you know, any of the amazing work that he had done. And I was like, yeah, wow, this guy has really risen up through the ranks of this company. That this guy that just does a local Canadian, assuming he just did the Canadian ones, these, like, you know, ads is now, like, on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave hope for Scott Stanford.
He was the former, what Jack Carpella has ascended to today.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so the match starts off, and I'm going to need some help here because I can't read shit on my notes. So, Wei, why don't you take us through some of the highlights of this
match?
Well,
at this point, it's important to keep in mind that Edge and Christian do not have their comedy shtick yet. Mm-hmm. They're really just two very bland wrestlers that have just broken out of the brood.
And really, none of their, like, for all four guys, none of their key spots, like even the poetry in motion, they really hadn't been introduced at this point. So this crowd was dead at the start of this match. I think they didn't know really what to expect here, and it was like 6 minutes, and then the crowd realized, wow, we're watching something important here.
Yes. I didn't really note specific spots here. I just kind of noted, you know, what really happened. This was the very first tag team ladder match, they said, and I didn't really expect anything different from it than other ladder matches, but once they got in there and they started doing all these creative things that are only possible with four bodies in the ring, and not only that, multiple ladders, you really started to see what made this match so appealing.
Well, there's like, and just things like spears off ladders, there's that amazing catapult spot where Jeff Hardy does the leg drop onto the ladder and then shoots up and knocks out Matt Hardy, and I believe it's Edge. And power bombs off ladders and things like that, where, you know, how many, because obviously Razor Ramon, Shawn Michaels, but like how many ladder matches had there been up to this point? Certainly nothing of this.
In the WWF, it had just been that, and like Michaels and Shawn did like a Coliseum video one, and within the company, I think that was about it. I can't even think of any others.
Rock and Triple H.
That's right. Yep.
But nothing like this before, and there's like one specific spot where Matt Hardy is in the corner, seated, and Edge and Christian open up a ladder, shove the top of the ladder into Matt Hardy's crotch, and the two of them drop kick the ends of the ladder into Matt. Stuff like that was great, and you could see as these spots progress, the crowd, which was, you know, probably not expecting much out of this match, they all started to wake up, and more started to become invested into this match.
You know, it was a big spot that I thought was the turning point. And, you know, you watch the latter TLC matches, and this was, like, fairly tame in comparison. But for this crowd, I mean, they don't have that reference. This was all new stuff to them. And Jeff was climbing up the ladder. Christian got up and hit an inverted DDT off, like, the third rung. And the crowd went nuts for this.
Oh, there's also, like, the hip lock that he does, a hip toss off the top.
Yeah, the hip
toss.
Like, just basic stuff that this crowd was going crazy for. And you think of, like, what they would later go to.
Yeah.
It was like, I almost think at times they went too far with their TLC matches, and I think they'll admit that as well.
Within that 2-year span, they definitely exhausted these gimmicks to their max.
Because they felt a need to just keep topping it. Mm-hmm. And this alone was just an inverted DDT off of a ladder. I mean, it would likely, 2 years from there, I don't think you'd get that same reaction, but the crowd was just thinking this was amazing.
Was like, the one thing that I kept going back to was the fact that, you know, with those TLC matches, because that's a little more what I'm familiar with watching from that time period, is when I think a table would be preferable to go through than landing on the floor and landing
100%
on these things.
Cushions your fall.
Yeah, it breaks your fall and stuff. So there are some of these bumps where I'm like, this is why that all these people, with the exception of maybe Christian, are in such rough shape now, you know, like either painkiller addictions or retired. And but also why doesn't TNA or WWE put a match like this on, like, find guys, because there's guys that do this every day in indies or, you know, well, not every day, but guys that can do this kind of stuff. This match just gets the audience so into it, and you leave just like, wow, this is,
I think it comes down.
Maybe not even a TLC match, but some sort of ladder high spot match. Like, this is just basically a spot
fest. I think, honestly, they want to get away from that. I think they really want to emphasize the storytelling aspect, because it was kind of this... this style of the TLC matches, and then you couple that with what, you know, the Angles and the Benoits were doing, and then you got that litany of, you know, neck surgeries for all these guys, and I think that's a large part of why they don't want to be doing that anymore.
But it's almost like if you could find a way to do this and give the guys that you give these spots to time to recuperate, like almost like a UFC style where you don't have these guys in all the time in this role, and they get the opportunity to kind of build themselves up. Because these sorts of matches, I just think... because the one problem that you have now is it's almost like a, you know, it, WWE, too much they're, as they deny that they're trying to do a UFC type thing, they are kind of like dialing it back in a way, making a little more realistic as far as the in-ring stuff goes. I think that's almost like, not that you want to take it the opposite way, but you kind of need those larger than life spots, is because, like, why wouldn't you just watch a guy in the UFC transition from hold to hold and knock someone out? Like, why not have this thing that's kind of different? Like, guys are still doing these high spots off ladders, guys are chasing guys into the back, things that you would not see in the UFC.
Yeah, it's, I think it is like almost a byproduct of this era now. It's like people expect all these big spots, and it looks like the WWE is almost trying to go in reverse, and they want to get to that spot where people will react to smaller
things.
But it's like, for the modern fan who's been watching for 10 years, I mean, you've seen so much now. It's very different to...
well, and they still use this stuff, too, in do not try this in home and all these sorts of...
There's a ladder match DVD that just came out.
Yeah, and ladder match DVD that just came out, and it's like... there's obviously they still want to make money off this these sorts of matches.
To a degree, they still do kind of let the guys go out on the Money in the Bank ladder match every year. That's kind of now become the two big matches once a year where guys can go out and do the big athletic spots and do the craziness.
So the finish basically comes with both teams on top of two ladders inside the ring. I forget who it exactly was, but
I think it was like all four climbing two separate ladders.
And it was like Edge pushing Matt Hardy off of one ladder. So Matt Hardy bounces off the ropes, collides into the other ladder, pushing Christian off. And so Jeff Hardy is dangling on one ladder, jumps from his ladder onto Edge's ladder, and knocks Edge down, and then grabs the thing.
And then takes a bump off.
Took a giant bump off the top of the ladder.
So at the end with the money.
That could have went very badly. Jeff Hardy is known to be somebody who takes a lot of risks, and here it was executed perfectly. The only flub was from Jim Ross calling Jeff Matt Hardy.
Yeah.
At the end.
Oh, they look alike.
But a classic match and a standing ovation afterwards for both teams. It was really the match that got them both noticed and kicked off the whole run with the
and
the Dudleys.
As big as the ladder match for them, the next night I always remember that the four of them came out on Raw and the whole arena gave them a standing ovation. Mm-hmm. And it was like at that point it's like you've really made these four guys. They had a specific role now in the company, whereas before they were just, you know, tag team number five and tag team number six in the division. Yeah. And they really kind of set their own kind of spot in the company at this point.
And what ended up happening with the whole Terry deal? Because that was such an afterthought by the end.
They eventually, we reviewed the event. She eventually turned on the Hardys and joined the Dudleys? No, I can't remember.
I think she was with the Dudleys for a minute.
Yeah.
I kind of have a vague recollection of that.
Yeah, so she ended up turning on the Hardys.
Okay.
And then we went backstage, and Terry is celebrating with the Hardys. This was not needed. Terry's chugging down the champagne, and Matt is just yelling something that was as incoherent as one of his YouTube videos.
There's a celebration. Terry has her man. Terry, it's all about us. It's all about you now. Look at this. We're going to come together. It's all about us.
I don't know what he was saying, but these two did not need to talk.
But this match gave me so much sympathy for these two. It's like seeing what they went through, it's like no wonder they're crazy.
Yes.
Like no wonder these men have gone to the lengths they have to try and medicate themselves, because they have taken some ridiculous pain and suffering.
And in a weird tie-in, they won $100,000, which was also the fine Jeff Hardy was given coming out of court.
Oh, really?
In September, he was fined $100,000.
God, hopefully he saved that money.
Hopefully. Maybe if
tournament money.
Maybe he has it in a coffee tin somewhere.
Maybe he can just live off the interest of it and pay off with the principal.
Yeah.
Who knows? If he invested well. So there you go. The Hardys, now aligned with Terry and Gangrel. What a foursome that is.
How long was Gangrel? Did he?
I think they got rid of him the next night,
okay.
I think. And then he just kind of wallowed away in the bottom of the roster and eventually was cut.
And then
he didn't really hear much from Gangrel after this.
Well, he did the pornos.
I mean, in the WWF.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I want to talk about these movies so bad. I love when Review Away goes hardcore.
Oh, Jesus.
Hogan Knows Best style.
That's the Ask Away era where we reviewed. Wasn't it one of Gangrel's ones?
No, it was not. It was the New Porn Order.
That was that was him, though. I think
he ran that company.
He did the New Porn Order. Yeah.
I have not seen one of these movies, but I still do not know how your mind switches from wrestling to porn that quickly.
The two are quite related. I would say you're both performing. You're playing characters that might not be yourself.
Yeah. It's a gateway.
It's a gateway.
Absolutely.
It's a gateway.
I remember the Gangrel's porno was much better, though, than the Hogan Knows Best one. That one was horrible that we reviewed.
Yeah. Neither of them were exceptional.
No. No, there's not a lot of high watermarks in that genre, period.
Yep.
Adult film.
It's difficult to just sit through an entire porno.
There's only one that I can think of. This is Cafe Flesh, which sounds terrible, the name, but it's about a post-apocalyptic world. And I can say the sex scene in it are incredibly bizarre and some of the least arousing sex scenes you will ever see. But it is
robots.
Well, it's very mechanized. It takes place in the future where people have been afflicted with a disease where they can't have sex anymore, except some people still can, and these people put on performance art pieces.
Oh, wow.
So the sex is very ballet-like in some ways, but it's also a very bizarre. The director went on to do Rinse Dream, I think, but he went on to do mainstream kind of art films afterwards.
That's a tough transition to make.
Well, also Abel Ferreira, who directed Black and White with Mike Tyson, Robert Downey Jr., and Fingers with Harvey Keitel, and the Tyson documentary.
Yeah.
He directed that. He did a porno film too, Cat of Nine Tails.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was a huge porn fan, so he decided, you know, what better way to be a fan than by getting into the world? Much like me in Review Away right now.
Yeah, it's just a little look at you. You're on all spectrums of entertainment.
Oh, exactly.
We move to the back. Sunday Night Heat. Mick Foley was wandering around backstage looking for The Rock. He runs into Hardcore and Crash Holly, plugs his book coming out later that week, says that Hardcore is in the book, but Crash didn't make the cut. And then he walks into a bathroom stall, and he's talking to whoever is taking a shit. Slides his book under, assuming it was The Rock, because I guess based on the shoes. And he walked out, and The Rock is walking down the hall on the phone, talking in character on the phone. He might have just been giving notes for his book, speaking in character. Remember, his book was coming out shortly afterwards?
Yeah, it was
horrendous.
Yeah.
His book was all in character?
It was all in character. It was terrible.
Well, it was before the success of the Foley book.
Yeah.
The two had come out at the same time, so nobody really knew what the market was demanding. And he didn't write it himself. It was ghostwritten. Yeah, it was no good.
It was weird. He, like his pre-wrestling stuff, he talked like out of character, like being, like playing football and stuff. And like he had some crazy like anger, like management issues. Like he would, there was one story where he snapped on someone on the football field, got on top of him, and tried to rip the guy's tongue out. Like, crazy shit.
Wow.
He just, that's nuts, man. Imagine someone trying to pull your tongue out.
That
to me would be one of the most painful things I could envision happening to myself.
Yeah. I don't know how it would be possible. How do you get a grip on somebody's tongue?
Because there's this, what do they call it, a Colombian necktie?
Peruvian necktie.
Peruvian necktie, which is where you cut someone's throat and pull their tongue out through it and make it a...
Wow.
Let it hang down, because I guess it's like
I'm thinking of the MMA chokehold, the Peruvian necktie.
I'm thinking of the Colombian necktie, which is like... Which is like, I guess, like a drug cartel thing.
Oh, wow. Jesus.
Because, like, have you ever seen a cow's tongue in, like, a deli or a butcher shop?
Yeah.
They're huge. Mm-hmm. So I guess the human tongue is quite a large organ, too.
I guess The Rock was
The Rock says,
trying to demonstrate.
The Rock says, I'm going to rip out your tongue.
So for more, go pick out The Rock's book. I'm sure it's in some used bookstore somewhere.
On Kindle now.
So he walks out. The Rock is on the phone, and Mick Foley is just completely confused here. He's like, well, where's the book I gave you? Knowing that he had just slid it underneath, I don't know, maybe he was having memory recall issues here of what had just occurred. And they talked back and forth, and this was one part where The Rock was a babyface, but at this point, I mean, the guy was just such an asshole mm-hmm. that it was very hard to really view this guy as like the top babyface when here you are with Mick Foley, and it's like, who would cheer The Rock over Mick Foley here? He was just such a prick to The Rock. He talks about, well, I'm going to get you an advanced copy of my book, and Rock basically says, well, sign it to the great one and then shove it up your ass.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that was sort of the status quo at the time. It's like, how much of a dick can your good guys be? But I understand what you mean, though. It was a little bit counterproductive when it got to that point, because Foley was just so lovable.
And Rock was not. He was just...
No, Rock was.
I think they were also like that reluctant tag team kind of dynamic, yeah, right, where The Rock never wanted to be associated with Mick Foley. Mm.
So then we have... Mick Foley goes back into the bathroom to get his book. He picks it up, and it was Val Venus who was taking a shit. And Val Venus attacks Mick Foley, and thus we have a match tonight between Mankind and Val Venus.
Val Venus is one of my most hated heels when he's a heel and a babyface. I hate him as a babyface too, because I remember he was on Off the Record, and they were attacking. It was like when everyone's like violence on wrestling, sex on wrestling, mm-hmm. and he's like, well, I was watching the TV the other day, and I saw on another network two men kissing. Oh, and off man. The record, I'm just like, oh my gosh. And he also wrote a conservative newsletter.
He was he was an extreme like right wing conservative. He's still like goes in nuts Markham. Online and stuff.
Yeah, well, because he went after John Morrison, right? He was like, how dare you say all these bad things. He did a video online and like was like, if I'm ever around you, you like look out, talk about your girlfriend, you put down Trish Stratus.
An extreme conservative played a porn star character in a pro wrestling.
He's a libertarian.
Libertarian, I was just going to say, you know? It's like, you know, a libertarian as long as you're not gay. Yeah. So it's like kind of like a modern Republican libertarian.
He was two men kissing.
He was ahead of his time, you know? Oh, he said two men kissing like it was like, you know, necrophiliac bestiality or something like they had talked about earlier.
So after Val Venus attacked him in his Tommy Hilfiger jeans, we announced this matchup. This was jeans equal tough, everyone. The Rock then comes out for a promo, and he challenges the winner of tonight's main event with Triple H and Austin. Does some catchphrases, walks to the back, but then Triple H attacks The Rock with a sledgehammer, attacking his kidneys and abdomen, and the medical staff, including BB, who is the large-chested Barbara Bush, came out to tend to The Rock. Barbara Bush would become Hardcore Holly's legit girlfriend.
She was one of the hoes. She's a
yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, she made
the
transition from ho to EMT.
To wrestler.
That's great.
Upward mobility in the WWE.
Yeah, they're diverse. Val Venus and Mankind. Venus comes out with Foley's book. They continue to plug it, saying that it goes on sale Thursday. Ross says it's one of the best books he's ever read, and Lawler doesn't believe him. Mankind is... Mankind in the back. He's checking on The Rock with the EMTs, and he says to The Rock that he's going to win this one for him. He comes out, and they fight on the floor to start, and Ross and Lawler put over Val Venus as being one of the most underrated performers in the company. So they were trying to get this guy over now as a heel, and going from the goofy porn star to serious heel named Val Venus was very difficult for this guy. He was someone who never really outgrew that gimmick.
Well, it's even like when he showed up in TNA and he beat Christopher Daniels on like the big TNA night. Yeah. And it's still like, oh, it's the porn star guy coming in and beating the serious wrestler right now. And it just, you know, once you, it's hard to recuperate your character once you're a joke.
They tried hard with him. They gave him a lot of airtime as Chief Morley.
Well, they love him there, right? Like he was always a guy that worked there for years and years. He was one of these guys like Chris Masters that you're like, oh, that guy's still here, like coming out.
He was always a really good worker, but just never outgrew that Val Venus character. And it's funny when you think about it, because originally Edge was pegged to take the Val Venus character, and you wonder what would have happened if the roles had been reversed. I always thought Edge is a much, much more dynamic performer.
But Val was excellent, though, at this Val Venus
character. He was great at being Val Venus.
Yeah.
And he kind of looks like Bobby Roode.
Yeah, a little bit.
Like that wet Jerry curl vibe and the shorts, you know? Like, I was like, oh, this is...
Isn't Val Venus from
Markham?
Markham, yeah.
Is it Markham?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, so...
Because I think he came up with Trish Stratus. That's why he took such offense to the WrestleMania John Morrison stuff.
Yeah, those Canadians, they stick together. They continue to fight on the floor. Mankind puts his hand into the trunks of Val Venus and pulls out Mr. Rocco. Lawler was so excited, thinking that his penis was being... pulled out on pay-per-view.
So
Lawler was just beside himself, like screeching here.
For a guy who's been married so many times, you'd think he would be over sex now, but he loves it.
Do you ever read his book?
I have his book on my shelf, and I've been meaning, actually, I mean to take it on this tour to read it, because
there's some good stuff in it. Like, his memory is, he goes all over the place.
Yeah.
It's like, one day it's 1978, the next it's 92, and then we're at 56, and wherever. But... the stories are good, but all I remember from that book was, it was just, like, so weird as he would talk about the current divas, and he talks about how if he could have sex with one diva, it would be Trish Stratus, and...
Oh!
Yeah, he said he would make drawings of the women. Like, it was just, like...
Weird. Was that in character? Is that book
I think part of it was, like, him, like, mostly the things out of character, but I always thought the women's stuff, he was trying to play his creepy old man, but it was just... simply creepy in this book, I thought.
Sure.
That's definitely creepy.
He's being honest.
But that was it. He was like, if I could be with one of the women, it would be Trish Stratus. Like,
she must have been so stoked.
How could you envision writing that about a coworker and then going to work with them, knowing that you...
Like, sign a book to them, like, page 286.
Just letting you know.
Just letting you know.
I could see, you know, like, dishing out some dirt in your autobiography about maybe somebody's past, but... who does he think wants to read that? Who does he think wants to know who he wants to have sex with?
Trish. In his mind.
Yeah.
She will be so flattered when she reads that I want to have sex with her that she will can help. Can
Jerry,
help
I never knew.
Yeah.
It's like Batista when he, like, just in his book, like, doesn't give a fuck. He just openly said he, like, had sex with Melina. While she was with John.
Oh, Morris. That's right.
He just flat out, like, outed her and stuff. It was like everyone knew at the time, but it was like it was never outright said. And Batista just wrote about it in his book.
It's amazing what people get away with autobiographies. Mm-hmm. I mean, can you if somebody said this in any other forum? Like, aren't there some grounds for libel?
Well, because it's your word against theirs.
Yeah.
Like, you'd have to be able to prove it in court that it's not true.
Like, how's Melina going to prove that that's not true? It's not like he's saying something necessarily offensive about her. He's saying,
I would say that's offensive. You're saying I cheated on
Well, he didn't ever say Morrison, but it was just the two were together at the time and people put two and two together. But, you know, it's not like he was saying New Jack going out and saying Terry had an STD. That's something that is could significantly, I don't know, hurt her in some way. I don't know.
And I think also if it involves yourself, too, there's like a, you know, it's like a part of Batista's history. All I can say is John Morrison, kind of a sympathetic character with this whole, like the way he's handled his career.
Yeah.
Like, oh, God, yeah, poor guy.
It's this weird mentality where it's like the company, like the word that everyone talked about was that Vince just lost respect when Morrison didn't try to attack Batista or something. It's like, well, you know, it's easy for the head of the company to say that, but at the same time, is a guy willing to get fired over doing something like this by attacking the top babyface?
Well, you get on the announce team if you do. Look at Booker T.
Yeah,
knocked out Dave Batista, and now isn't on the announce team.
Such a weird company.
Like, there's no other environment that mimics it. Like, from the
high school.
High school, yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, high school. I guess high school. High school with no teachers and no authority, even though those authority figures are not always helpful. But
like a high school gang, maybe.
High school.
The best analogy, I can't remember who told me this once, was that like those who get into the wrestling industry, when you get into the business, it's like your maturity stops at that level. So if you get in at 19 and you have a 30-year career and get out at 49, it's like you stay on that mentality of a 19-year-old. It's like your maturation process stops when you enter this business because it's so fucked.
Well, also, I think being in a band, like being on the road that much makes you crazy.
Yeah, I don't
know. Like you're so self-absorbed because there's nothing else around you that is consistent except for the people around you, obviously. So you just kind of internalize, and I just think it pickles the brain.
You've got to like just, you know, when you're on a long tour, at least you know there's an end point. It's like, I get to go home at some point, whereas, like, how could you tour year-round, every year?
That's the thing, because you know, when tour gets hard is when you know that you're going to, when you're like, okay, well, tour will be over in a week. And then you're like, but then I have another tour 2 weeks later. So it's like the tour is not really over. And
sure.
And I can, it's probably, you know, 10 times. I think we played 100 shows last year.
Wow.
Which... compared to a wrestler, like how many days are they on the road? 260?
200 or so.
Yeah, and it's like, wow, that's a way harder schedule.
Like a Miz and Cena, it's like, Jesus Christ, they're on the road well over 300 a year.
Yeah.
Easily.
I mean, yeah.
It's just an unbelievable grind that some of these guys are on. But what would that, 100 shows, like how many, like you're throwing in on top of that, like travel days and
stuff.
Like,
I mean,
it's like half more, the year you're probably gone.
Yeah, I think it's a little less than half. But like, yeah, because it's like we're pretty good about budgeting our time when we go out. But yeah, no, it does kind of, you know, like as glamorous as like staying in a hotel every night kind of seems, like you get sick of them and things like that. But once again, kind of first world problems. You know? Yeah, another thing about touring that sucks is the food's never really that good.
Fucking phone, my internet's down.
Yeah, sometimes you don't even get to use Wi-Fi.
Oh, tragic.
Tragic.
Did we finish this Val Venus for Mankind match, or did we trail off in the middle of this? Oh, this was all on Lawler getting excited about the penis.
Yeah.
So the match continues, everybody.
Because the finish of this is amazing.
Oh, Christ. The agent deserves a round of applause here. So Mr. Rocco is pulled out, and then Mankind comes back with a clothesline, sends Venus face first into a chair. Venus comes back with a back suplex to Mick Foley on the floor onto the chair.
And just destroyed the chair.
An open chair.
And this was when Foley was like, by his own admission, he couldn't do anything at this point. His body was wrecked at this point. He was getting by with comedy, and here he is, back suplex onto a metal chair.
To no effect. No reaction at all. This was like a
this crowd, like, they didn't give a fuck about Val Venus.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, unfortunately, Val Venus and British Bulldog were kind of put in these spots to try and hopefully it rubs off on them being in with The Rock and Mankind, but nothing. It's like they viewed Mankind was the star here, and Val Venus is the obstacle in front of him.
Yeah, jobber.
The Tommy Hilfiger jeans guy and the non-Tommy Hilfiger jeans guy. Maybe it was the jeans. But Val Venus wrestled in his trunks, didn't he?
Yeah, well, he was in the V, purple Vs.
Of course.
Maybe it's the fact that he took a shit just like an hour earlier in the show. And
or his name rhymes with penis. All of these factors could contribute to this crowd not caring.
And he didn't have the Super Soaker yet, right? Or is this after he had the Super Soaker gimmick, where he used to come out and spray the crowd with
the Super Soaker? Oh, my God.
Before.
Then they had the castration thing with Funaki, right?
That was like one of the first things that he did. So probably before
this. I remember. Was it once when DX did that with the where they squirted the audience?
Yeah.
And it was like to insinuate that the crowd was getting hit with semen.
Well, there's a...
what was wrong with this company?
It was actually in the last match. I had something in my notes that I forgot to mention. But there's one part where they're talking about, did you see that shot? You should. And then he's like, you should have seen my shot earlier. And I'm like, are they talking about ejaculating? And then it's like, oh, he's talking about when he was looking up Terry Reynolds' skirt.
There was a one pay-per-view poster, and it had Triple H on, and he's against a turnbuckle, but the turnbuckle is coming out between his legs as he's doing the X, so it looks like a giant red penis is coming out, and the slogan is fully loaded, cocked, locked, and ready to unload. I'm like, how is this possible? Like, they had, like... It was just amazing.
And it's even more weirder hearing Jim Ross, the straightest, like your dad, basically, commentate throughout this whole thing, saying these things.
He'd have to be like Eugene Levy in American Pie here, where he'd just have to be kind of get this across.
Yeah. Well, he was probably coming up with some of this stuff too, right? Because he was an agent, or no, he's had talent relations, right?
Yep.
I can't see that man capable of cocked, locked, and.
Oh, he wasn't coming up with these slogans, but it was quite the time period if you were a wrestling fan. So the match continues after this. We go into the ring where Venus... at first, Mankind goes for a mandible claw on the floor and gets the back of his head smashed into the steel post. No protection. This is the worst part of your head to be making contact with anything. Then he reapplies the mandible claw and gets smashed even harder back of the head into the post. And then Venus brings a chair into the ring, goes to hit Mankind with it, but Teddy Long pulls the chair away. Mankind attacks him, hits a Russian leg sweep onto the chair, gets a two count. Crowd just dead for this. None of these near falls they were getting into. Venus goes for the money shot, but Mankind gets out of the way. Double arm DDT. Mankind gets a two count, and then Foley pulls out Mr. Socko. Valvinus has Rocco, and we have the mandible claw applied, and then Valvinus applies the testicular claw with the big drama, who would fall first? And Valvinus fell on top of Mankind for the pin at 9.5 minutes.
So Valvinus,
the worst finish ever.
Valvinus won by dick grab.
Yes.
Basically.
Like, that's the finish.
Yes. You had this guy take a suplex onto an open chair on the outside, but he loses to the testicular claw.
Yep. Socks or a household item. I don't know. So that was that, everyone. Not Mick Foley's finest moment, and probably not on one of his best of DVDs.
No.
And Mankind got his heat back after the match, attacking Valvinus, and he left with both Rocco and Socko on both hands.
Well, he went to do the double testicular claw, yes. and went after him. It's like his hands in a C formation. And went charging after him, and Valvinus got away.
Oh, the comedy that...
Did it build to that spot? Was, like, this go on, you know? And, like, did they eventually, like, that was the payoff? Like, you finally get to see him apply the...
I pride myself on my memory, but I think I also have a filter that just expunges certain shit.
I finally stumped John Pollock.
There you go. I have no recollection. The Rock is in the back being tended to and selling in character his rib injury.
How those sledgehammer shots earlier that he took looked amazing from Triple H. Like he was like landing that sledgehammer.
Yeah, maybe
on
he was.
Yeah, maybe he was.
Hunter can lay his shit in. I was saying on Monday that work punch he gave R-Truth looked great on the ramp.
Mm-hmm.
Looked great.
Could have been a rubber sledgehammer.
Yeah, well, that's steel, like, that would hurt coming down on you, but I'm like, maybe they cast it in something a little lighter, which would still really
remember
hurt.
When they had Jim Duggan and he had, like, some plastic 2x4 once, and he attacked guys and it started bending? Jesus Christ. So then coming up next, I was like, there was like 45 minutes left here, and I'm like, what left is there on this show? I can't remember any of this. And we've got a Four Corners elimination match coming up next involving X-Pac, Kane, Farouk, and Bradshaw.
Yeah.
This show came to a grinding halt here for the next 15 minutes. Four Corners elimination match. X-Pac comes out and Lawler talks about the heart that X-Pac has and says, you know, JR, he has an enlarged heart. Which is one joke that should never be made on a pro wrestling show, ever. Ross reminds us, as all four come into the ring, the Acolytes come out together. He reminds us this is a Four Corners match, even though by every stretch of logic, this should probably
should
be a tag match. We have two baby faces and two heels, and we're going to have an elimination match.
Weren't they building to them becoming an alliance? Because they did a tag team run together, Kane and Kane. Yeah,
I think that was before this.
It was before, and I think this was right before X-Pac was going to turn on Kane. This was before all the Tory craziness where, was it Tory that got the? It was some weird shit where they had a match where Tory would spend the holidays with the winner, and I guess X-Pac fucked her, and then Tori would turn on Kane.
Kane, yeah.
It was one of many Kane romance angles that I always loved because it was Kane.
I kind of like – I still actually – I wish they found a way to put the mask back on Kane. Like maybe – because I liked him a lot more with the mask on.
They were kind of teasing that once when they had the fake Kane.
Yeah.
Because they blew that off, and he took the mask at the end of that program. But they never went anywhere with it. I've always said this before. I've always enjoyed Kane because any shit they'd throw at him, be like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
And he could pull off the weirdest shit, like the Gene Snitsky feud.
He could go to space.
He's like, fine, put me anywhere.
Put me anywhere.
I've got this cackle, and I can put any segment over. So here we go, four-way. This was not the strong work that would come a year later with this company. X-Pac hits a plancha to the floor, but gets caught by Bradshaw, who runs him into a post. X-Pac and Kane would end up together in the ring, and they go back and forth. Kane went for a chokeslam, but then Bradshaw stops the chokeslam by tagging in, which made no sense here, because it was not one fall to a finish. It was just everyone would have to be eliminated. So why would you stop Kane from chokeslamming one of the obstacles in this match for you to win?
He wanted the glory.
Okay. Farouk is then holding X-Pac, but then takes a boot from Kane. X-Pac gets a two count. Oh, man, these notes. I really should. We need a better printer, Way.
That is crazy. Are you printing on the... I think you're printing on scrap paper on the wrong side, though.
That's the state of our paper situation at our office, I guess.
We're trying to save paper.
Yep.
Well, that's a better way, environmentally sound, but notes hard.
Yeah, logically not sound. The heels beat down on X-Pac. He gets a hope spot with a tornado DDT onto Bradshaw, and then Kane gets the tag, hits a top rope clothesline to Farouk, and then a choke slam to Bradshaw and eliminates Bradshaw. X-Pac then comes off the top with a spinning heel kick, and you wonder why this guy has spinal issues and multiple issues at his age now. Spinning heel kicks off the top rope, not the most... smart idea, I think.
Like, I know he got everyone, he was like really annoying, and there's that go away heat that he had and stuff like that. But I always found X-Pac kind of entertaining in the ring.
Always
like,
he was a great worker. I don't think anyone talks about him being a bad talent in the ring. I think it was
his
similar to Val Venus, where he had the okay, we got the six Pac thing. It's like, okay, it's the playoff Tupac. Now it's like 2000, and it was like, what was his character? It was like he had no. Okay, it's like I knew nothing about this guy.
He was still living off of DX like 5 years later.
Like, he just felt like a dated character by 2000.
Mm.
And so he eliminates Kane, and then it's down to Sean Waltman and Farouk. And the finish comes. X-Pac went for a Bronco Buster, but it gets countered by a Spine Buster. Farouk puts Waltman on his shoulders, goes to climb, but X-Pac gets off. Farouk then dives off the second turnbuckle into an X-Factor. Not a spot I'd be booking 300-pound Ron Simmons to be executing. X-Pac hits the X-Factor. 10 minutes, 17 seconds, and X-Pac gets the win. A forgettable match.
Just didn't seem to click with the crowd at all. At one point, X-Pac went for that hot tag on Kane. It was like the most silent hot tag I've ever heard. They just weren't into X-Pac, even by this point, as the underdog for whatever reason.
Well, all these guys also, like, are the Agrolites just seem so... Acolytes. Agrolites. It's a ska band. but they just seem so, like, lost as a character without that giant religion cult angle kind of backing
like
them up.
Yeah, like that had been done for months, and it was... Yeah.
And they still have those weird drawings on them. Same with Midian in the first one, too.
Yeah, this was like this weird... like transition period before they would come to the APA and be the, you know, the Texas Rednecks. Or...
But I still like, and Bradshaw's like definitely one of my favorite heels of like the 2000s. And he, who would ever guess that he would develop into what he developed into?
I mean, he was just such a small presence on the shows at this time. He was just like, he was just the random guy in the Acolytes and what he would become later. Like, just a fantastic promo. And he was a, no, I never assumed he would ever get anywhere kind of out of this kind of mid-card team role.
There's that one match where it was like an I Quit match him and John Cena had. And I think that's the only time I've wanted John Cena to win as a babyface.
Yeah, that thing was a bloodbath.
Oh, it was amazing. And just like, you just hated Bradshaw so much for what he did to Eddie Guerrero and like what he did to the Blue Meanie at the ECW pay-per-view where you're just like all these behind-the-scene things you're hearing. And he like... He's like one of these guys that just knows that if you're going to be a bad guy, you got to live the bad guy. You got to be a bad guy at all times.
He works at Fox News.
He
did all this stuff that it was like, he was like, I'm going to be the ultimate heel here. And it's like, even the like hardcore fans who just tune in and watch this as a show, I'm going to make them not like me.
Yeah.
And it was like, he was able to do that. Edge got to that point, I think, after the whole Lita Matt Hardy story. Like, that's when Edge went to another level. And it was a... point in time when like JBL and Edge were just huge heels.
Oh, absolutely. But I think Edge also deep down kind of like wanted to be a good person. Like he came back on that run and he was like a baby face, and then he was put in this heel by the real life situation. Mm-hmm. Whereas Bradshaw, you could tell he's like, I'm going to live the gimmick.
Yeah.
You know,
but
I'm going to be
rich. When he was done, though, it was like when he knew he was done, it was like I interviewed him a few times and it was like, nicest guy in the world. Like, he'd make fun of his own matches and stuff. He's like, oh, that last year I was just terrible. It was all smoke and mirrors and stuff. He's just like the most personable guy, because I think he realized, okay, the character's done now.
Yeah,
and he just took it to that next level of, I'm going to play this heel.
I've even found it hard when he was an announcer, because I thought he was a great announcer.
I loved him as an announcer.
But just like even forgetting the fact that I hated him so much as an in-ring performer. As a heel in-ring.
The announcing role, I think, was when everyone kind of just turned the corner and realized just how great this guy was.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
he was just so good at taking the focus off of himself and putting it onto these heels. It's like he would be such a welcome addition right now.
Oh, it's like if him and Mick Foley, like Mick Foley, you know, would obviously fill a different role. But if you got those guys in some sort of non-wrestling capacity behind the scenes, and because even Michael Cole's, he's not bad as a backstage interviewer. I like him more than Josh Matthews. Like when he's like interviewing those people backstage, give him backstage, make him a heel manager.
Yeah, you know? Just seem they have so much invested in him that they just want him to be front and center.
It's so distracting.
Yeah, like, I agree. And it's results in, like we said, with like these mid-carders and no one cares about
them.
Look
like
at Daniel Bryan now.
Yeah.
Perfect example. I mean, he is non-existent.
Well, when you watch these matches and you're like, we're talking about the ladder match, like something that these people that had happened before in other federations, maybe not like this extreme, but, you know, no one had ever seen something like that. Like, once if they put Daniel Bryan in like a CM Punk out and just said, just do what you do for like 30 minutes. Like, no one would have seen something like that. Like, Daniel Bryan, that aggressive, throwing, like, the MMA elbows that he does and doing all these moves that I think it would go over with the audience in the same way you had this ladder match go over, because people just want to see something new and something different and exciting.
Yeah.
We go to the video. We have to check in with The Rock once again.
Yeah.
His ribs still hurt. They have now taped the ribs. This was like angle alert for the end of the show.
Yeah.
By
he
constantly
refused
reminding
to go to the
us
hospital.
The Rock is still here.
Yeah.
His ribs are in bad shape. Beware. So then we went to a recap of the Triple H Steve Austin feud. It started at SummerSlam, where after the match, Hunter attacked Austin's knee with chair shots and took him out of action. And then we went into a music video by the renowned H-Blocks.
Did they ever tour?
I have no clue.
Because I was like, man, this band could have probably done all right at this time doing like a tour, maybe get a wrestler to do an autograph signing at the same time.
This was H-Blocks with an X at the end instead of an S.
Oh.
Yeah. And they recapped the six-pack challenge where Austin was the ref and had to count three for Hunter and then stunned him afterwards. They recapped the rattlesnake angle where Hunter faked being bitten in the face. And, yeah, this is where they show China aligned with Hunter here. So very odd pairing here when you have her as a babyface in one storyline and a heel in the other, with the biggest heel in the company.
Yeah, and she's an active heel and also a really sympathetic babyface at the same time.
She's just won the Intercontinental title. So
she was the Mr. Kennedy before there was a Mr. Kennedy. He took China's alignment and Road Dogg's gimmick.
Yes. So here we go. Main event, Triple H Steve Austin, no holds barred match for the WWF title. Austin challenging for the title here. And we come out, and immediately Hunter has a sledgehammer, and Vince McMahon walks out and tries to grab the sledgehammer and take it away. He gets shoved over, and then Austin runs down the ramp, attacks Hunter, and that's where the match begins. And for the first, 7-8 minutes, they're just brawling all over the Gund Arena. At one point, Austin took the jib camera and flung it into the face of Hunter here.
Yeah,
this was a six-figure bump here.
I wonder if they ran that by Kevin Dunn beforehand. He might have been just shocked. Like, what is this?
Did he actually take the bump from the boom part? Like, I don't think.
But then they did
smash into a camera at one point. Like, Austin smashed his head into the camera.
Yeah.
Directly.
It's great. I think Austin's wrestling style is incredibly perfect for this type of match. He's just a really great brawler. You know, like, his movements just look so wild and uncontrolled, and even in his punches and the way he walks around, I just think he's a perfect guy for this type of match, and it worked here.
Yeah, the crowd was into this match pretty much the whole way. They went into the audience. At one point, the camera lost them. Dunn was probably fuming multiple times during this match. We move into the ring, and that's where things kind of slowed down when Hunter got the heat and he started working over the knee of Austin, which was the story they had been telling going into this match. At one point, we get a shove spot between Hunter and Earl Hebner, which they seem to do in most matches involving the two. And from there, Hunter continues to work on the knee. Austin makes a comeback, grabs a chair, but gets cut off by Hunter. And then from there, take us into the finish, Way. I'm struggling here on my horrible notes. The finish spot here was where, both trade visionary falls because the ref gets knocked out. Austin hits a stunner, but there's no ref. Then he gets Mike Chioda, who's revived. He gets to the apron as Austin cuts off Hunter, and then Chioda gets knocked off again off the apron, who is he was trying to outbump Mae Young. And then Hunter hits the pedigree, but there's no referee again. Yeah. Earl Hebner runs in at this point, and Austin kicks out at two. And the finish comes as The Rock comes out with taped ribs.
And a sledgehammer.
And a sledgehammer.
And he attempts to hit Hunter, but Hunter ducks. And so he hits Steve Austin. Triple H pedigrees The Rock and covers Austin for the victory. So we are left with Austin and The Rock laying, and Triple H standing above the two victorious. So there you have it. Triple H put over.
Hunter, he's exiting with the title. Austin attacks him from behind at the entrance, and they fight to the back and into the parking lot where China, the new Intercontinental Champion, has a limo ready for Hunter.
And they throws him in.
And they make off in the limo while Austin's chasing them, and that's how the pay-per-view goes off the air. And this would build to, they would set up a three-way between Rock, Hunter, and Austin for the Survivor Series, get you to buy the pay-per-view, and then swerve you out of Austin. So that's where they went after this one. But that was No Mercy.
Austin, like, how could you not love him at this time as, like, a babyface? Like, you just – and especially, I think the way they built this, even though they kind of robbed you of that Rock match, they were kind of teasing when Rock got taken out with a hammer. That was going to happen at the end. I just think, like, what a great way to build Triple H as this, like, horrible heel that's, like – Just
gets by on the skin of his teeth.
Skin of his teeth, and like was going to like force Austin to lose his cool and get disqualified, and then just Steve Austin is this great, unbelievable worker, and just so much fun to watch.
They really put a lot of work into Triple H into getting this guy over, because wasn't this his second run with the title?
Yeah, they had taken. Remember, they put it on Vince for like a week, and then they put it back to Hunter. It was like,
but like
very
I remember like that initial run that he had.
He wasn't clicking. Like even at this point here, it was like he was very lukewarm in this role, and it was really that Cactus Jack feud a few months later where suddenly everyone bought him now as a main event level heel. Right. And this time period, I mean, the company was on fire. And a month after this, they were going to lose Austin for a year, which is amazing when you think about it, how they were going to lose their biggest draw in the company. And it forced them that they'd have to get The Rock into that top position. Mick Foley was definitely slowing down at this point, and he'd be done by WrestleMania. So they had it in their mind that they had to be creating other guys beyond just Austin and getting – you know, top heels ready for Rock.
What a good position, though, to be in the WWE, where you have these guys kind of waiting in the wings that you're like, okay, you're doing really good right now. We're going to put this on you. If Cena were to get hurt tomorrow or Orton were to get hurt tomorrow, they have no, CM Punk, I guess, could step into one of those spots. But, like, you know, what would happen if both guys got injured? You would lose your main event.
And that's also one thing. It's like at this time, I mean, when the product's really hot, it's really easier to try and make stars, whereas you look at now, I mean, I think so many fans have got into guys, whether it be a Jeff Hardy or a Rob Van Dam, and seen them just, you know, we'll push them for a few months and then we'll pull back. I think a lot of fans right now, it takes a lot more to get a guy over, and you're totally right. Outside of that top three of Cena, Orton, and Punk, I mean, good luck, like, with John Morrison at this point.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
Like, no one's buying that guy at this point.
But we are seeing them. You know, this Mark Henry situation is a similar deal with the lack of depth on SmackDown. They're really having the force to push guys like Mark Henry, and they've been successful.
But Mark Henry, I think, you know, like as great as this run has been, you kind of knew he had it in him because he had that other run with Rey Mysterio a couple years ago. Was it Rey Mysterio? Where he's like, I'm going to eat you down to the white meat. I'm going
to
get down.
Maybe not eat you down.
Wow. I want to break in open your skull and get down to where you keep the white meat or something like that. It was like this amazing promo.
Wow.
And so, you know, you kind of knew he had it in him. But whereas in the babyface side, and like I guess if you lose a heel, you probably heat up Dolph Ziggler or break someone off and swagger
Cody,
maybe
for
from
sure.
That. But like babyface wise, it's like, yeah, John Morrison's kind of your next biggest babyface at this point.
It just seems that there's this mentality though for a lot of the mid-carders or whoever where it's like they'll point out one part of them that doesn't work and they'll just, well, they can't main event because of this. They can't talk. It's like if you had that mentality, a lot of people, well, Mick Foley doesn't have the look that we want, or you know, Hunter, he wasn't, no one was responding to him the first 3 months as a heel. Let's give up on him. Whereas instead, I mean, Brock Lesnar, when they first started pushing him, he was like, he wasn't great in the ring, but they didn't give up on him. And 6 months into it, he was improving.
Yeah.
And by the end, people bought him as a star because it's like we say with promos, when you repeat it over and over again and you present a guy as a main eventer, eventually people are going to accept them as that if you book them strong and you protect them and you hide their weaknesses.
Doesn't always work, though. I mean, look at Crimson and TNA.
But I think that's the one thing I'll say about TNA versus WWE is WWE almost like holds guys back too long, whereas I think TNA, because they don't have a developmental territory, just as soon as they get someone, they're like, okay, put them out there, and we'll see what happens. Like
they're also pushing the wrong guys. I mean, Crimson had no type of there's no sign from the audience that says that they want this guy to be pushed.
But I think he's all right. I think Crimson, like, he sucks in the ring, but he's great on the mic. I think he's good on the mic. And he was someone that if you had put the time in and maybe got him a little bit more ready for TV, he's someone that the audience could believe in, you know? And like that's the thing about WWE is they kind of like...
I think that's the biggest problem is that if you're not one of the top three, you don't believe in
you
these
don't,
guys.
Yeah. Yeah,
what faith do you have in it? You know, a Jack Swagger, you feel that he's doing well, maybe he's clicking, boom, we beat him in 30 seconds to Zack Ryder. It's like, why are you going to get behind a guy?
Yeah.
It's so hard right now. Like, I just wish they would just have the confidence. Let's get behind Dolph Ziggler. This guy's great in the ring. He can talk. Let's just, it doesn't work. But if you're going to only give him a half-ass push, what do you expect? He's been in this spot now for like 3.5 years in this mid-card U.S. IC title spot. Same with Kofi. It's just like they get cold feet on these guys to go all the way with them.
Well, that Intercontinental, the U.S. champ spot is like purgatory.
It's death.
You get stuck in there. Unless you're Mark Henry, who was never, I guess, in that picture. But like, yeah, you're going to be trapped in there forever, and you're going to be cutting Evan Bourne, Kofi Kingston, smiley promos or angry guy promos, and it's the same thing over and over again. And
Kofi was clicking a few years back when they did that Randy Orton
feud.
People were into him because they believed it was a new guy and they're going to make somebody here, but then they just gave up on him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was right back to where he started, and he's in that purgatory as well.
Yeah, like, and it's just, and you watch this, you watch the product here, you see the audience, like, so excited, and then you watch now in WWE and it's like there's not that excitement level, like, except for like when you do have a CM Punk situation, or you did have that walkout. Like, I thought that walkout was, you know, not,
I thought it was the show with at least interest.
Yeah, absolutely. I was excited. And you actually made a great point, Wade, that I'm going to, on Review of Raw, yes, today I listened to it, but last night, I guess, where I kind of like Johnny Ace. I think I like him as a heel. Mm-hmm. Like, and I think while totally embarrassing and horrible what they did to Jim Ross, but I thought the way he did it, like, oh, you want to see him suffer.
He's very smug.
Yeah, very smug, and also just got like that guy that's been like biding his time in the back, waiting for the opportunity to kind of like snatch power away. And the one thing I'm worried about, though, are they building to a Johnny Ace versus Vince McMahon match? Is that going
to
be?
You almost get the sense they're building a Johnny Ace Jim Ross match.
But Johnny, like, you know, he used to wrestle, so, and Vince McMahon, you know,
they
once
could
in
do
a while.
Johnny Ace versus anybody match.
Yeah.
You know?
You could get one match out of him.
Absolutely.
Oh, I'm sure you could.
The one, it goes back to, you know, in terms of, like, being a heel, it's like even that diehard audience that's maybe, you know, that got into the CM Punk stuff. You look at Johnny Ace, like, here's the guy who replaced Jim Ross, mm-hmm. legit, as the mm-hmm. head of talent relations. Look who the company signs. It's like, it's easy to really dislike this guy.
Oh, yeah.
Like, legitimately, rather than just a character.
So, really, what we're saying is this was a good choice to put Johnny Ace in this role?
I think he's a good choice to put in that role. I think just every other choice has been bad.
He gets great heat when he comes out.
Oh,
he comes out, everyone boos him. So we'll see where it goes. You able to stick around for feedback?
Oh, I would love to.
Hold on a second. What do you guys rate this show?
Oh,
I'm going to give this one a 7 out of 10. I really enjoyed the main event. The ladder match was great. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm being a little too high on this because there was some crap on this show, but I thought those two matches really delivered.
I give it a 7 as well, but I don't think that's too high because this ladder match really is historically significant in my opinion. Not only that, but we have the China-Jeff Jarrett situation, which I thought, first of all, for the significance that as it relates to TNA, also because I thought it was kind of entertaining. And the main event I thought was pretty solid as well.
Yeah, I you know what, I was going to say 7 too because I think that ladder match, you can't show that. Even someone who's a non-wrestling fan and not get them excited about what they're seeing because it's just so crazy. And, yeah, like Steve Austin, amazing in the role you put him in. And even those, you know, I guess they'd be Divas matches now in the women's division. Like, compare that to, like, you know, once again, not to beat up on Kelly Kelly, but compare that to watching, like, a Kelly Kelly or a Winter thing in TNA. It's like...
It was fun.
Oh,
was
I would I would gladly take China beating up Jeff Jarrett any day and Moolah and Mae Young taking bumps any day over watching Kelly Kelly try and run those ropes.
So, pay-per-view that had a lot of, historical value to it, whether it be, you know, Jeff Jarrett's final night with the company, the ladder match, which would spawn, you know, a huge era for the company with those four as well as the Dudleys. So, an interesting show to look back on. And we'll start off the feedback with Brian Camacho. I actually enjoyed this pay-per-view when it took place. Edge and Christian versus the Hardy Boys set the bar high for future ladder matches. Good choice, John and Way, for reviewing this event. Keep up the awesome work.
Josh Kachenko. The N64 game was 1,000% more memorable than this event to me. I was in the Army at the time, and we would cram into somebody's room every week for wrestling and pull money every month for the pay-per-views. This struck me as a typical Attitude Era run-of-the-mill pay-per-view with overbooking and stips. I remember the ladder match and remember it being quite enjoyable, but it didn't make me remember what show it was on. I remember that Val Venus went over Foley at some pay-per-view in a screwy way, but again, it didn't stand out that it was this show. I think it really can be summed up as the definition of a typical Attitude Era pay-per-view. It had all the elements of the era, but wasn't a classic. It just blends in with the rest of the shows that aren't classic shows everybody remembers. Hell, if not for the video game, I probably wouldn't remember this was the name of the pay-per-view. Was this what the video game is based on?
Was it called No Mercy? No Mercy, yeah. That's like the last of... Was that the last of the amazing wrestling games?
Yeah, I think the roster was their THQ games.
Yeah.
The roster was based on the 2000 version, I would think. Because WrestleMania 2000 came out.
Right, and then No Mercy came out later.
Yeah. Well, did they do another No Mercy the next year?
No.
That was a great name for a pay-per-view.
Yeah. I never understood why.
Oh, you mean did they do another pay-per-view?
Yeah, no. Okay, because they had that as a series, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was always surprised, you know, when I understand when they made the change to the concept pay-per-views, but it was like, you know, these pay-per-views had been around by that point for like 10 years, and you just kind of like dropped the name, but I don't know how much it had.
I also liked when they did the In Your Houses and they named the pay-per-view after sort of the big feud that was going to be featured on
good
it.
Friends, like the UFC. Better Enemies.
Better Good Friends, Better Enemies, exactly. Where I just watched that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
One of Kevin Nash's two good matches.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it was on WWE Classics this week.
Oh, really?
Or last week. But because these generic gimmick pay-per-views, you get burnt out on them.
Yeah, I don't know. Concept shows, just like, well... I don't know. I got down on Hell in a Cell where it's just like, I don't know. It used to be such a big deal.
Well, Hell in a Cell now is just ridiculous. Like it's like be like having a hardcore pay-per-view. When you can't have guys bleeding, what's the point
TNA.
Of having that stip?
They have that. They have Hardcore Justice.
That's true, actually.
But I think what they're trying to do is cater towards the people that don't watch wrestling, that just scroll through their guides and see, oh, TLC or Hell in a Cell. Maybe this will be worth it.
But I think also as a wrestling fan, you know when this pay-per-view is coming up, it's like, oh, great. Now they got the creative team is going to be trying to find ways of working these into these stip matches they have set up. So they're going to have to, like, expand the programs to get, you know, four people in or expand for Survivor Series or do all these things where you can kind of telegraph where it's going to go by what pay-per-view is coming up. Whereas with these sorts of pay-per-views, you never know how it's going to develop into the next one.
All right. You're up next.
Well, I was thinking about this on the way here in case you guys wanted me to read feedback, but I think people send in their feedback to hear you guys read it. So if they hear me read it, it will not be – I feel like I'd be robbing you send in this feedback. You want to hear John and Way read it. You don't want to hear
Damien. They want you to react to it, though.
I will react. Right. Believe me, you cannot shut me up, but –
Dave Power writes, this was the first VHS WWF pay-per-view I bought, mainly for the excellent ladder match, but I really liked the good housekeeping match, too. I think it should also be pointed out that this period was Austin at his most selfish. He wouldn't put Triple H over at SummerSlam, and even here, he wouldn't help the new... Spell check is great. wouldn't how the new top guy a clean win, even though he knew he would be put for a while with... Okay. Yeah, this was a period in time where, I mean, Austin was the top guy, and he was selective about certain guys he wouldn't work with. He didn't want to work with Billy Gunn because he didn't see him at that main event level. And in that regard, he was right, I think, in terms of, you know, having Billy Gunn go over him. Didn't want to work with Jeff Jarrett at the time because, they had some issues, stemming from prior issues. And, at first with Hunter, yeah, it was, they did put Mankind into that match, but, you know, I'm always, you know, there's times with making guys, and there's also, you know, this is a industry where you do have to be selfish at times and think for your own character.
But I feel like the difference between what Austin's concerns are compared to, like, maybe a Hulk Hogan, for instance, is that he has the business's best interest in mind.
That was the difference I always saw.
Yeah,
he was never someone who was just going to, you know, come out and do a promo where he buried guy. Everything was business for that mm-hmm. guy. And that mm-hmm. it was just black and white. It's like he had a big picture in mind. And that's where I always saw a difference with Austin, where he was looking at what value do we have in Billy Gunn legitimately? What are we getting out of me putting him over, and why am I going to hurt myself to make this guy?
Or that Brock Lesnar situation that led to him walking out.
I don't think anyone would disagree with it. Mm-hmm. It was stupid to throw that match on TV. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, I think, and I think the other thing with Steve Austin is he's a huge star, and huge stars have big egos, and he, as someone who's, you know, fought their way into this position, they're not going to want to see someone undeserving get beside them because he's fought his way into it. So.
And I'll even say to Hogan, too. I know a lot of people will rail on Hogan, but in the 80s, I mean, he was very selective with jobs, and the result was when he did,
it was
remembered. I mean, everyone will remember when Hogan lost in the 80s. I mean, it was very infrequent, and it was infrequent for a reason. Mm-hmm. And I thought Hogan was fairly business as well. He would devolve from that at a certain point in his career. But that's why I'll get very frustrated when Hunter will do a promo saying that no one in the locker room is at me and Taker's level. What is the upside of that comment versus the downside? Mm-hmm. It's like, there's no upside to me. It's just, let's just hurt our own talent. So it's a political beast, everyone.
Well, and Hulk Hogan, you know, when Hulk Hogan does it versus when Stone Cold Steve Austin does it, it's like, because Stone Cold Steve Austin could still go. You know, and Triple H could, like, this is Stone Cold Steve Austin until the injury, but, like, kind of at his peak
right.
of his powers. Whereas when Hulk Hogan's doing it, or even when Triple H is doing it now, these guys are in their twilight years of being a wrestler. So they're, you know, now's the time to pass the torch, you know, like Steve Austin mm-hmm. was not in a position to pass the torch. He's still the biggest guy in the company. And also these guys, and Steve Austin would still be beaten up and still would be go down on his back on a show or a pay-per-view because he knew it would build up the next thing. I don't think it's so much John Cena not wanting to do that, but they just don't have John Cena or Randy Orton ever. You never leave a show with them laid out, beaten up, like what's going to happen next week. They have to come back. And
yeah. It's weird. With Cena, it's like, I don't think the guy has any issue doing jobs.
No.
But the problem is, there's no consequences with this guy. When he gets screwed out of a title, it's just he's happy face John Cena the next night, and he never cares, and therefore I don't care. Like, look at Hell in a Cell. He got locked out of the cell and got fucked out of his title. He hasn't referenced that once.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like if he doesn't care, it's like, am I spending my money because I care? Probably not.
So no, it's a fault. It's a fault of the writing. It's a fault of the character. Jay Hunter. I thought Jarrett's phallocentric wife-beating Hyuk gimmick was awesome. It really suited him. I bet he loved doing it and wasn't too much of a stretch. Who knew how important his and Rusev's relationship was to the future of pro wrestling? I always saw China as an exemplary product of the system. She couldn't wrestle or cut a promo, but all thanks to Vince's booking, she was a megastar. But then I was resigned to believing that she'd become world champion one day because of her popularity at the time and the positive press she'd bring to the WWF. Thankfully, Triple H's selfishness put a stop to that. If he never married Stephanie, do you think China would have eventually got the title, even for a short stint?
They WWE seems to protect their title in a little more
at that time.
But even now, like I couldn't see them putting it on a joke champion like WCW would.
I could see it. I really could see it, especially if you had certain writers at the like. David Arquette won the title. Come on,
that wasn't in. I'm saying in WWF.
WWF.
Fine.
Yeah.
But you don't. You never know. You really never know. What if Vince was so desperate and just imagine the headlines: Woman wins world championship.
Business was so hot then. I don't think they needed it.
How about when business wasn't so hot?
Well, that's now.
Yeah.
They're gonna wait till Awesome Kong comes back. Maybe she will be the first female heavyweight champion.
I don't think it'll happen now.
No, I don't. This is right. Vince Russo hates women. and I don't want to sound slanderous when I say that, but the evidence.
I don't know how you go away from Impact every week, knowing who's writing the promos and how you don't come to that.
I just can't even Mansoor's comes off like a Bikini Kill record compared to Vince Russo's writing and booking. It's just like a.
How much is it him actually hating women though, or is it just what he thinks makes good TV? I mean, if you look at what was hot at this era, it was hoes, it was sodomizing your opponents. This is maybe his mindset still today.
Yeah, that's true. He's looking at the Jersey Shore and being like, okay, that's how kids want to talk.
He'd be he'd be an interesting subject on In Treatment or something like that.
Well, yeah, because you can tell he's someone because he's a born-again person, that he's been through some conflicts in his life, personal conflicts. But I'd love to read an unauthorized biography of him. Someone that actually went through, interviewed everyone that's worked with him. Not his book, but someone that actually went out. I think it would be a really telling portrait of the most powerful person in wrestling without any talent.
Five and Dime Ho, a look inside the psyche of Vince Russo. Mark Robinson, I saw this pay-per-view on VHS years later, and I thought it was a decent show. Not great. Only things I can remember from it was the excellent ladder match and the Triple H Austin main event. That was a pretty good match itself, and the Good Housekeeping match, which is only more interesting if you know the backstage stuff involving Jared and Vince McMahon, which I think has to rank as one of the few times where a wrestler has really gotten one over on Vince. The rest of the show really wasn't that memorable, though.
I don't know how much he got one over on Vince.
He's someone who
he landed
made
on his feet
off a shitload of money. Yeah. And never really needed Vince, even when WCW went out of business. I mean, he earned a living in this industry, which is not easy to do when you're on the outside of the WWE in 2001.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he also made himself into, his dad's company, but he was a main event talent. He was never really a main event talent prior to TNA. And so,
what if TNA folds in a year?
He'll wind up on.
You would hope that guy's saved some money over the 25 years of working this business.
I think if TNA folds, there'll be an immediate federation that'll kind of take that spot, it's not going to be a Ring of Honor. It's going to be someone that's doing it because people want the WWE product more than one night a week. And so there's always going to be something in there.
I think Jarrett right now is doing some of the best work he's ever done in the last years as this heel character. I mean,
he's a way better heel than he is a babyface. When he came back and he was sympathetic, cleaning the toilets, and you're less oh man, I want this guy to be the jerk, the king of the mountain,
tapping out kids in a
jiu-jitsu
school.
That was amazing. That program, for how terrible it could have been, was awesome.
Mm-hmm. Is it me?
Yep.
Brian Kamach. Brian. No, sorry.
Nick.
Nick Susi, what in the heck is Midian? I mean, if that wet fish ever walked into a bar I was in, I would not have a second doubt that I could mush him up good should he start to bother me, which he would. The Moolah match was incredible. By incredible, I mean terrifying. They are either incredible workers and fooled us all into thinking they are old, or they just took some hellacious bumps that they felt for years after. Nice to see that even after May bumped like a drunk Ric Flair, Moolah still didn't want her touching her new belt. Looking back, I was astounded at how much the New Age Outlaws managed to get the audience eating out of the palm of their hands. In today's era, reactions like that are just the hope and dream of the entire roster. On a side note, Crash Holly sure has a knack for recovering from famousers on steel chairs in a hurry. The rest of the show is all you could expect from 99 WWF. Male versus female matches, gimp dominatrix outfits, silicon and steroids, cheesy titantrons. That sums it up.
David Banks, For every star in the business, there has been that one match that has made them a star. Sting at the Clash of Champions 1, Austin at WrestleMania 13, Shawn at WrestleMania 10. The ladder match at No Mercy 99 made Edge and Christian and the Hardys stars. They took the ladder match to another level and thanked the WWE for letting them have that spot to show what they can do. No one knew what to expect from these four young men at the time, but if you had the pleasure to see this match in 99, as I did, you saw something that you never saw before. They walk in as really curtain jerkers, but walk out as made men. They ushered in an era of tag team wrestling along with the Dudleys and set the bar for tag matches. I love this event for the sole purpose that it made new stars for the future. Look at what it did for Edge and Christian, and even they have had personal issues of late. Matt and Jeff have had a great career. Years from now, these four men can all say they started it at No Mercy 1999. That should be on the back of, like, the No Mercy
yeah.
VHS.
And this should just be a
30, put that over huge.
A 30-minute tape is all you need.
That match is phenomenal, and No Mercy, if for nothing else, should be remembered. But the Dudley Boys coming in, like, that really helped that.
Mm-hmm. It injected even another
you
layer.
Needed it. You needed yeah. heels.
And who would have thought, though? Like, because they were such an unlikely combination when you think about it. Because you had these two teams that were really, like, cruiserweight type of high-flyer teams. And then these two big guys that just didn't really fit in. But yet they did so well.
It made sense to me. Especially in a ladder match. You want those, like, they always have, like, the big guy in there is like your base to do a lot of your high spots. And it was just, you had six guys that I think all had really good minds for putting together matches. Mm-hmm. And it was just a perfect combination of guys to put together these matches. And it worked tremendously well.
David Banks, for every...
Next one.
Alex Rios. My God, as much as I love this pay-per-view, can we say this was an Attitude Era one-match show or what? Don't get me wrong, I did enjoy it. And it had its good, like Stone Cold versus Triple H in his last match, at least from what I remember, before the big Survivor Series angle that took him out for surgery. I think that was a fairly decent match that covered for Austin's injury limitations in a street fight. The great ladder match, what can I possibly say? It was great, not the best ladder match ever, but by far the best since WrestleMania 10, my opinion only, and it started the TLC era following up with all the crazy Hardys, Dudleys, Edge and Christian matches, which are definitely classics of the year 2000. Now onto the bad. What the hell was The Rock doing, toiling in the mid-card, wrestling a blown-up British Bulldog, who was Putski winner by far? Jesus Christ. Mankind and Val Venus. This happened on this show? Yikes. But still, great show to watch. Better N64 video game. Thanks for the reviews. My suggestions for you guys is Armageddon 2002 featuring the three stages of hell match featuring Shawn and Triple H.
All right, we go to Ben Lowe. I think they should have done the injury angle with Austin after this match with Triple H, not the next month at Survivor Series when they promoted him in the three-way with Triple H and Rock and put someone else, maybe Foley, in his place for the triple threat match at the Survivor Series. Well, Austin was the golden goose at the time, so I thought they could get one more pay-per-view buy out of him.
Okay, let's go to Dennis Amaya. No Mercy 1999 is a show that is best remembered for the incredible tag team ladder match, but did feature some good matches on the show besides that. The main event between Triple H and Stone Cold was excellent. This show did also feature the best match in China's career. Jarrett had to carry her to a good match. Knowing what was going on in Jarrett's contract at the time, it makes it a very interesting match to watch. The Outlaws-Hollies match was also pretty good and had, in my opinion, a creative ending. Of course, the ladder match was the best match on the show. This match was the match that put both teams on the map and really elevated their feud. Everything in the match was near perfect, from the crowd reactions, the spots, and the announcers. The match was just superb. The show also had a huge misuse of talent. The Rock and Mick Foley should have had better opponents. The Rock's match on the show was probably the worst of his career. The opener was shit, and the women's match was pretty damn funny for being one of the worst matches I've ever seen. All in all, a pretty good show with a couple of good matches, one great match, and a near perfect match. 7.5 out of 10.
Okay, let's go to David Warden. It's strange watching this back. As I think you guys have said before, the quality of matches was way better in 2002 and 2003 as a whole, but the crowds were dead and buy rates and ratings way down. In 1999, the crowds were red hot and bought into all the storylines. I guess it was just a special time when everything seemed fresh and even the bad stuff was over with the crowd. Ratings were high, so Vince gave his stars the chance to develop their personalities. I can't help thinking if they'd seen higher ratings this summer with Punk, we could be seeing some special television right now. I love the simplicity of King and JR with Finkel announcing. Just feels right and allows the wrestlers every chance to get over. Also, I like having Rock where he was on the card. You don't need your main guys headlining every month. Cena and Orton, take note.
Yeah. I don't really disagree with that. I think you could have your top guys just do some jobber matches once in a while.
But you don't have anyone to take that top spot. You know,
not
you need
right
to have.
Sure.
Like, I just, like, even if I kind of, I'm really excited that they have some people in development now that are, you know, I think Claudio Castagnoli, and if Chris Hero makes it over, I think those guys are big guys. That
still could, Tyler Black down there.
Tyler Black.
Forever.
Yeah, he's been there forever, and I don't, you know, almost in developmental hell, but
yeah.
I kind of think, you know, those are guys being kind of bigger physically that they might push them a little harder, and they're both so talented and stuff, mm-hmm. So that's kind of my hope that there's going to be. You know, they need baby faces. They definitely need someone for people to like because they've got a overabundance of heels, but no one to.
And but even for those two, I think it'd take them years before they reach the main event level.
Well, but then you think about Brock Lesnar. How long did it take for them to get Brock Lesnar into like?
He's a very special.
He's a very special case, but like they can heat people up. Like you just have to make it believable. You just have to protect them and put them in the right matches. And
he was a great case of someone who can't. He had a great look. But the negative was, okay, he's super green and he can't talk,
Which
are two giant negatives. So they put him with Paul Heyman, they put him in short matches, and by the summer, the guy was headlining SummerSlam and with The Rock. And by the fall, he was like full-fledged star in the company.
What I think also when there was like that moment where they're kind of giving even Shelton Benjamin that push, and he fought Shawn Michaels on Raw in that amazing match.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, like if you had this guy go over Shawn Michaels, like, yeah, that's a huge thing, blah, blah, blah. But you automatically have someone that everyone's going to be interested in. Like, if you have someone that finally can beat Cena clean in like a real convincing way, like, because no one's done that in so long, I think that's automatically going to get someone kind of elevated to the next level.
Well, like, we know Vince is so much about the look, you know, and like why Brock Lesnar was such a special case. He had the look, but he could also move as well. So, like, if we see a guy like Mason Ryan get that type of push, it's not going to work.
No.
You're right. You're completely right. Mason Ryan is a short match.
I don't know why they let him grow his hair out. Give him the Batista hair back. Now he looks like he's got, like, some sort of, like mop top perm thing going on. Like, when he comes to the ring, it's like Harry Potter hair.
Maybe he'll have his autobiography one day, some revelations.
Patrick Tony, what I like most about the Attitude Era was how everyone on the roster was over. Did anyone think Bob Sparkplug Holly would have been that over? The only low point on this card was the women's match. I hated how Vince kept inserting Mae Young and Moolah into the women's division. It was like watching WCW, the female edition. Speaking about the women, I have a question. Who was the worst between Chyna and Kelly Kelly? Overall, I give the No Mercy a 7 out of 10.
That's really tough.
Easily, for me, Kelly Kelly.
Yeah.
Like, Chyna, like, when she's in the ring, you know, it's rough, but it's definitely rougher with Kelly Kelly, or it's definitely, you know, rough with Kelly Kelly, but Chyna's not making those annoying noises and, like...
Chyna also had the benefit of being in with people like a Jarrett or a Chris Jericho who could do... walk Chyna through a match with her eyes closed, and it was so I thought she always had the benefit of being in there with seasoned workers while Kelly is
You put Kelly in with seasoned, you know, female wrestlers, she still sucks.
For me, with Kelly, it's like the second she hits the ropes, I'm out of the match. I'm just done. It's like, this is ridiculous.
Are we talking strictly in-ring or just as characters?
In-ring.
Even as characters, like,
Chyna all the way. I mean, Chyna made a lot more money for this company, was a lot more valuable, was more useful in a lot of storylines, but even as a wrestler.
But how many Twitter followers does she have right now?
Chyna?
Versus Kelly Kelly.
Does she have a lot?
That's what they plug Kelly now. They say she has the most Twitter followers of anyone in the Divas division.
Oh, wow.
So that's a big high water mark in 2011.
Yeah, that's – man, whoever – like WWE, it took them a while to get into the Twitter, but now that they're into it,
Fuck,
my God, they will suck the life out of that.
I noticed, like,
I want Twitter to become a subscription service just so WWE revolts and gets rid of it.
I felt like this past Monday, when they were plugging the chance to watch Vengeance for free, if you tweeted about Raw...
They come across like grandfathers, understanding anything.
But, like, it was so obvious that those were recorded afterwards.
Yeah, they had a few of those in there.
You can hear just the awkward pauses.
That to me, like, and I know people have said this time and time again, but that was, like, really this week, that's when it felt broken. Like, the show, Raw, just felt like a broken show. Like, it just, the audience wasn't into it. Like,
They were for the main event.
The main event, yeah. Yeah, but, like, it just felt like a really weird thing to watch, especially after last week, kind of, like, everything kind of spiraling out of control. And instead of being, like, stick their guns and being like, we're going to push this through, it's like... You immediately have your main heel power figure come out and rehire the person he fired last week, like taking all his power away.
It's an admission that they made a mistake.
Yeah, it is, exactly.
And the final piece of feedback this week is from Jason Thomas. Just remember when you guys bashed Vince Russo, he was writing this stuff when everyone was over and the crowds were hot. I know he left for WCW right around this time, but Russo was the head of creative for years leading up to this show. That's right, that Vince Russo, the one you all hate. So, thanks for the trolling. But let's clarify here, Vince Russo, okay, folks? First of all, he had something that he never had in WCW and does not have in TNA, and that was an editor. In this case, it was Vince McMahon, who... multiple ideas that Russo would throw would never make it to television because they were simply, well...
insane.
Yeah, and they would go into Russo's back pocket for his WCW run. Second of all, he was also hands-off when it came to the main event programs. I mean, he was in the mid-card, and I think we'll all give him credit for giving a lot of these mid-carders personalities and getting a lot of the mid-carders over. I've always said that was a big strength of Russo at the time. So, you know, the good comes with the bad, and to simply... write Vince Russo off as this genius at the time, I think, is somewhat overstating the fact when a lot of people give him the credit for Rock and Austin, and he was really not that involved in a lot of the top programs, whether it be the Hart Foundation angle, Austin, Vince. I mean, he was really taking care of the mid-card talent, which he did a very good job at that
time. And also, this is a boom time. It's, like, easy to write for a boom product. Like, you know, the crowds are hot because the crowds love wrestling at this point. And you know, like, who wouldn't want to be a writer where people are just... chomping at the bit for your stuff.
And that style that he was championing at the time, this trash TV style, was incredibly fresh in the late 90s.
It had a limit, and WWE went past that limit. By 2003, when they were doing the HLA stuff, mm-hmm. I mean, that was not...
It was dead.
Fresh, it mm-hmm. sounded it was desperate.
But when I watched TNA, this is the same stuff that was hot 10 years ago that expired within 4 years that they're still trying to replicate right now. So that's the knock.
So there you go, everyone. He's now simply writing the show. It's not his ideas anymore in TNA.
So maybe you guys understand. So Dave Lagana's come in as head of creative writing.
He's going to be the director of creative writing, but he's not actually working on Impact. He's working on a separate project that they are forming to launch in India. So some people are confused that he's coming in to write Impact.
Yeah,
he's not writing Impact.
Okay.
So it's this project, and apparently... I think Dutch Mantel is going to be involved as well. It's this new promotion that they are going to be forming in India. And I think Sanjay is going to be a part of it. I think even Jeff Jarrett might be
moving over there
to do this project. So it's kind of something completely separate. And he's coming up with like international shows and ideas for that. So
that's very smart of TNA to try to expand that territory.
Yeah, it's.
I don't know what WWE's reach is India right now, but.
Well, I think it's very good that they're bringing Dave Lagana in to write for it, because if you had Vince Russo writing for it, there might be riots. Because my friends playing this band, and they toured India.
Yeah.
And at one night they kissed on stage, and there was a riot.
Wow.
On the show. Yeah, the Black Lips, when they were over there touring, two of them kissed on stage, and people just, like, lost their mind. There's different social mores when you go into foreign, you know, obviously foreign countries. Like, when you, I imagine coming from India to North America, you'd be shocked at some of the... So
Russo would have a fucking cab driver character.
Oh, yeah, no, it would be, like, you know, the bitches, whores, like...
cows.
Lesbian angles, there'd be riots.
Cows wrestling each other.
Oh, Jesus.
They'd kill a cow on stage.
They'd have, you know, like, the Catholic character coming in.
Eating a hamburger.
They'll have a British colonialist kind of come in, like a, and then they have like a Gandhi type character. Oh, V. Man, we should just ask Russo if we can write this, because I think we've already
7-Eleven as a sponsor.
It would be a little racist.
Yeah. My God, this is the byproduct we are, everyone, of wrestling for the majority of our adult lives. That is going to wrap us up. Marathon edition of Review Away.
Sorry, I'm sorry. Hey,
no, the more the better.
I feel like I've cheated myself, though, this week, because I really look forward to my Wednesday walk to work with Review Away, and I can't listen to myself.
Oh, man.
Sure you can.
Well, I can, but I'm going to feel weird.
What's coming up for you? I know you got a lot of stuff on the go.
Yeah, I'm, I guess, touring. I'm about to go on tour next week to Europe. So if you're in Europe, come hang out. And then I'm going to Australia with the Foo Fighters and Tenacious D in the end of November, beginning of December. Wow. Should be a weird little tour.
Have you been to Australia before?
Yeah, we did this tour called the Soundwave Tour, which is like a big touring rock festival there's like on one level you had Iron Maiden, Zach De La Roca, Slash, and then on the other level you had little bands like us, and it was a lot of fun. If you've never been to Australia, it's almost like Vancouver Europe. It's like if you took Vancouver and dropped it off in England and gave it hotter weather. I'm looking forward to going back and getting a chance to meet Jack Black.
Ask him about Nacho Libre.
I think Nacho Libre I want to talk to him about. I also want to talk – he was in a Yola Tango video or did something with Yola Tango. And, yeah, like he was on Yo Gabba Gabba even. So, And then I'm also next week on The Wedge, we're doing a Halloween special where I'm trying to find ghosts. So it's
at base, lower base.
Lower base station, the Masonic Temple. We are going to like legit ghost spots.
And that's cool.
Hopefully, I really want to get haunted by a ghost, but it hasn't happened yet.
And according to the internet, you've got a show November 14th in New York.
November 14th in New York.
Breaking news, we're playing
our whole record. Yeah, breaking news to me. We're playing our whole record start to finish in New York. So if you're in New York and you have 72 some odd minutes to spare, come see us play our whole record. Fantastic. And Titus Andronicus are opening, who are in a phenomenal band.
That's all coming up. You're always welcome to come back here, Damien. Let me tell you,
this is a thrill of a lifetime for me, gentlemen. Thank you for having me, listeners. If you're still tuned into my voice, thank you for staying tuned in, and I promise I won't be back next week.
Oh, no. We got lots of feedback the last time. I think a lot of people will enjoy this. We're going to be back on Friday with Review and Impact with myself, Way, and TN8, Milton from Virginia. Right. He'll be chatting about the fallout of Bound for Glory with us. And as well, next week, Way, we're going to be reviewing the Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels Greatest Rivalries DVD. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have another mystery reviewer with us in studio.
Whoa.
Full of mystery.
And it's not me, because I'm on tour, so don't worry.
He's on tour, so you can start guessing, everyone. Someone who was with the company at the time.
Whoa.
So that's going to be coming up next week.
And on The Law, I believe you'll be giving away copies of the DVD,
yes,
right?
If you want to tune, in a weird way, we're all part of the same family.
We are all part of the Bell family, Bell Media.
It's a big family.
I do my TV show. Well, I don't. I write, well, whatever I do for my TV show, mere offices away from where you guys record The Law now.
Amazing. We are there Sunday nights, midnight Eastern time, and this Sunday we'll be joined by Bret Hart and giving away copies of the Greatest Rivalries DVD and chatting about the Vengeance pay-per-view, because there is a WWE pay-per-view this Sunday.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
No wonder they're giving it away for free. It's like, you want it? You take it.
So that's all coming up here. Damien, we'd be remiss if we didn't let you pick the song, though, to go out here.
Oh,
Review Away.
Man.
Putting you on the spot here.
Okay, you know what? I'm going to pick something wrestling and music related again. Why don't we go out with – actually, I'm a huge CM Punk fan, and the only time he's ever acknowledged my presence is when my friend Toby from the band H2O got him to tweet at me, because he's really good friends with him, and I know CM Punk's a big fan, so – here's I See It In Us by H2O.
Awesome stuff. We're going out with that. We'll chat with you on Friday.